I'd like to call to order the November Commonwealth Transportation Board work session and welcome everyone here. There are a number of very contentious and long items today. We do have a 6:30 dinner engagement at La Grotta, which we fully intend to make. I hope that's incentive to keep the dialogue to a minimum. What I would like to do is, before we start into the program, because of the nature of several of the issues on the agenda, is there anyone from the general public who has come here today to address the board? We don't typically do citizens' time, but I did want to extend that opportunity during the work session. Just a note on the item three, which is the six-year program. I've had a request from Mr. Dickens, who is coming up from an event in Hampton Roads, and he asked if we could push that down the agenda a little bit until he arrives here. Mr. Sterling is in California, unavoidably on business, and will not be able to join us today. I believe that Ms. Pandek will be with us ultimately, but probably a little bit late. So with that, I'd like to start with item number one, which is an update on the ERA, otherwise known as the Stimulus Program. Welcome, Mr. Chief Engineer.
Well, I'm here as the assistant to the Chief Financial Officer, Rita. She normally gives this presentation, but she told me she'd be standing up here a long time going over a few other things, so I'm going to take her place. First thing I'd like to do is, it's your place. You should be able to find this right here. And basically what it is, it's the front sheet, it's our home page in the web. It also, right here, this little thing is the ARA. You hit that, you can go to the second page in here, which has all the ARA data. You should also have, the fourth page should be a map that you'll see a picture of the map in my presentation. It shows all our ARA projects on it. And the last thing I have included for you is a list of all the projects. This is what you could get if you went to the website and wanted to print off and see what we have. There's a few other things you can get from the website that I didn't give you, but I just wanted you to see that as I get started here. A lot of the things I'm going to quickly go through are slides you've seen before just to reinforce. We've met all the statutory requirements for the ARA funding, and we'll deliver the projects on schedule. And as you have done, we focused on transportation funding, strategy investments that will create jobs, address infrastructure needs, and provide for new transportation solutions for Virginia. The same slide Rita showed you last. This right here shows a breakdown, and you've seen this before. These are contingency projects. You see the last $64.3 million. If you added up all those numbers, it exceeds our $694.5 million. What I want to say, and I've received several requests for ARA funding. All ARA dollars that you have been allocated to a project. There are no additional ARA funds available. Everything, and you'll see as I go through here, we've either already obligated, awarded it, or we have a schedule and a target to deliver those. Not only VDOT, but all the MPOs. This gives the MPO information, which is similar to what you had last month, $117.8 million. This gives an update from what you saw last month. We have 70 projects been obligated with a total of $312.1 million. 39 projects have been advertised with a total of $337.8 million. 42 projects have been awarded with a total of $250.4 million. The reason there's more projects awarded than advertised is a few of those projects were for right-of-way and PE, and we just included that total in the awarded. All the remaining projects, both CTV projects and MPO projects, are underway with a target obligation and advertisement date, and any savings on the projects as we go through, we will apply those to contingency projects. And we're starting to see, for instance, we had allocated about a little bit over $66 million in the bridge area. It came in with contingencies and everything about 50.7 or something. So there is additional funding from there that we would see. And so as we're going through, what we do is we go with the federal government. We de-obligate money and set the what the obligation and what our contract costs are the same, and any additional funds that we had obligated, those would be funds that you'd be able to address on any of the contingency projects as we go down the way.
Mr. Curley, can we just go back 1 second
sure.
to the previous slide? You mentioned 70 projects have been obligated. Isn't that the term project is actually a contract? Because as I recall, weren't there about 110 structurally deficient bridges awarded in 6 or 7?
Yeah, we're talking, when we talk about projects, I think we're using UPC numbers the way that we're doing those. So, for instance, there were 12 projects in the design-build contracts that we had, 12 UPC numbers in those 7 design-build contracts that we put out, but that was 119 bridges that we addressed. So it depends on how you look at it. And, you know, we were grouping a large number of bridges and culverts together to make the what we put out attractive to contractors and also reasonable for somebody to be able to do. That's why in those particular projects, they were geographically grouped as we were putting it out.
So, but just from a layperson's perspective, you've got closer to actually 200 projects if you add up all the projects that have been awarded, the bridge projects plus the standalone individual projects.
Yeah, you would. We counted it as 12. It's 119. That'd be 107 more. That'd put up about 177 on those by itself. And I think all the other ones are independent projects. So we're probably up in about 180, 185.
Okay. Thank you.
I just wanted to report to the board that the board at the last meeting gave the commissioner the authority by resolution to award ARRA projects that came in before the board meeting. That authorization goes through your next board meeting, I believe. Yes, through the next board meeting. It goes through this board meeting. It ends at the December meeting, I believe. We did award the Wichita Road project down in Virginia Beach on November the 3rd. Bids were received on September 29th. We had 10 bidders on that project. There was a little bit over $10 million, $10.6 million from ARRA funds that you allocated to that project for construction. E.V. Williams was a low bidder. This shows the contract price of a little bit over about $7.5 million. Engineering contingency is about $2.3 million. So it came in at $10.8 million. Because we had about 2-week time period there, I requested the commissioner to go ahead to pick up that 2 weeks in the process of moving this project forward. So this project has been awarded. I anticipate before your next board meeting that we will award the Phase 3 project on Fairfax County Parkway. It's a design-build contract that Eastern Federal Lands is leading with us, and that should be finished up, I believe, next week. This shows the all the projects. It's a map that you have that shows all our projects around, shows the MPO areas. We don't have all their projects on. It would be too many on there with that. And this is through October 28th, so it probably needs to be updated if anybody wanted to go and count all those little dots and what's filled in and what's moving forward. And that's a brief update of where we are. Like I said, the information I gave you that's on the website shows you all the projects we have. We do have targeted dates to meet those projects, and where staff is working toward those.
Questions,
any questions, sir?
Questions, Mr. Curley?
Not a question, but a comment. I think that this report shows that our utilization of the stimulus money is one that has a longer or more sustaining impact on recovery for the economy. And at the same time, it attacks some of our critical needs. So while we've been criticized for not fast dashing out, handing out the bucks, I think it's very important to note that this is the way that it should be done. That we should attack the critical needs with the monies that are available instead of just spending it on something that's easy to do and turn the money over. So I applaud that and think that this would help sustain recovery over a period of time as we attack these projects.
Thank you, Mr. Keene. Any other comments? I would like to echo what you said. You know, the choices you could... Remember, these are 30-year treasury notes. Do you put that into a paving project that has a 4 to 6 year useful life, or do you put it into something like the rail enhancements at the Port of Virginia that are going to have long-term economic benefits for the entire Commonwealth, or the Fairfax County Parkway that serves 10,000 new jobs? And those are more longer-term projects. Any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Curley. Excuse me. Item number two is the FY 2010 budget update, and as I indicated earlier, we will wait until Mr. Dickens get here to take up the six-year program issue. Welcome, Ms. Buescher.
Thank you. I'm going to start out by taking us back in time just a little bit before we move forward. I know you all have seen this slide before, but it's what we've been dealing with since June of 08, when we received our first revenue estimate reduction in this recession. We lost $1.1 billion in June of 08. Then in February, that was the biggest hit with regard to transportation revenues. We lost approximately $2.6 billion in state funding. And recently in August, another rounded to $0.9 billion, but it was approximately $883 million over the 6 years for a total of $4.6 billion.
And Ms. Buescher, could you put that $4.6 billion figure in perspective? What's that?
Yeah, I would say in the original 2009 Commonwealth Transportation Fund budget was about $3.8 billion, so it's more than one full year of the entire transportation budget.
So we're running a six-year program on 5 years of revenue, essentially.
Yes.
Or less than five. Thank you.
In November, we received an additional forecast adjustment for fiscal year 10 through 15. In the August reduction had us reducing revenues in 10 of about $155 million. This reduces the reduction slightly to $152.6 million in 10 for a total of $875 million over the 6 years. It's a slight improvement, but if you've read today's paper, I believe with the sales tax component of our budget, there is likely to be further reductions in our future. I don't know if that will be in the December time frame, which is what the article seemed to indicate. It would be before the governor's budget was presented. But right now, we can't say that this is the end for us for 10 or 10 through 15 in terms of reductions. We usually present this slide to give you an idea of the components of the reduction, so the $875 million over the 6 years, the bulk was the motor vehicle sales tax and the retail sales. And so to highway maintenance, that was $230 million, and the TTF was $644 million reduction.
Ms. Buescher, and the base on this is compared to the program that was adopted in July? Is that the...
Yes. Yes.
So the July
to the original
program,
10
the July program.
Program
is that which was adopted in June by this body, and you can see the individual components by year and by source for where, the best estimate we have available today.
Now, there are some changes that have occurred in this upcoming budget that we would be looking for you to revised budget we'd be looking for you to adopt next month. With some of the revenue changes that have occurred, we will be reducing our use of CPR bonds in that the insurance premiums, again, declined slightly. So our bond issue that we're looking at in the end of this year, the first of next year, will have to be reduced, the value of the sale. We did receive, and I reported last time, $28 million of federal bonus obligation authority. We had obligated all our federal fiscal 09 federal funds, and we received an additional $28 million, so that's reflected in this program as an increase. We also received some open container fund resources from DMV from time to time, and we chose at this point, since we were updating, to go ahead and add that funding to the program. We have reduced funding for the revenue sharing program as what we had indicated previously to the board, what our plan was to reduce state funds from that program and reduce the bonds associated with that. We also had approximately $13 million in the Route 58 bond program taken back into the general fund this year, and then some other miscellaneous changes. So what I showed you in the previous slide, the 875, with these pluses and minuses that the changes we've made to the program, the bulk of which would be the bonus OA and the open container funds, which are positives, our reduction goes down to $851 million over the 6 years. So it gave us a little bump. So in 2010, we're looking at approximately $94 million.
Mr. Chairman, another point of clarification, please, because we're already just getting started and we're already deep into a lot of numbers. But, Rita, could you, just for the general education of all listening, point out the difference between the $4.6 billion reduction and the $851 million reduction? I know they're related, but sometimes people get confused, and it would be worth clarifying that.
When you go back to the 4.6, the August number is in that total, the 900.9 billion. That was the $883 million reduction over 6 years for starting in 10 that I had introduced at the last meeting. Since then, that number has gone down slightly based on revenue changes to 875. And then that number, due to us adding the bonus OA and the open container funds and a little bit of shifting, some miscellaneous, it's now down to 851. So instead of 0.9, at 0.85. And that reduces this number just ever so slightly.
Exactly. And that's on top of the two previous reductions.
Absolutely.
It still pretty much adds up to 4.6 billion.
Absolutely. Flatlining, basically.
Or said another way, the rate of descent is slowing.
To briefly talk about some of the budget assumptions that we are dealing with in this update for the 10 through 15 financial plan and the 10 budget. We did have to reduce previously planned employee pay raises in 2011 and 2012, and that was statewide directive. In 10, and I'll show you in a little bit, we're proposing some maintenance funding reductions in 10, similar to what we did in 9 to balance 10, in that we're facing reductions in the year in which we're operating. So we looked at available resources in the year we're in for 10, and we're making some reductions. But the next bullet we'll talk about going forward from 10, beginning in 11. We are planning and hoping we can continue with the growth of maintenance funding being returned to 4% annually. But it will be based on the reduced 10 number to start with. So that 4% growth will be on the reduced 10 base going forward. So maintenance funds for 10 are less than the 09 original adopted budget for maintenance, which means, unfortunately, secondary and urban maintenance funds will not meet maintenance needs. We're actually reducing the locality maintenance payments this year by approximately $10 million, I believe. And this will, going forward, require an increase in federal funding movement to maintenance to support that growth rate. And as I mentioned before, the revenue sharing program in 11 is being reduced to the minimum of $15 million allowed per code, and we're recommending eliminating it in 2012, which will require budget action.
Requires legislative action or budget?
Budget language.
Okay.
To give you a little bit more detail about VDOT's portion of the 10 reductions, let me start with the administrative side of the house for 10. We're looking at our equipment inventory program, which is outsourced to a company called Mancom. We're reducing those services by approximately half, so that will be an ongoing reduction. We are delaying for 1 year equipment purchases, some capital outlay for facilities improvements for 1 year, and we have some capital outlay balances or funding that wasn't spent previous to 10 that we will put on the table one time. And then the payroll reductions that I spoke of a few minutes ago, which does include the furlough day that's being recommended statewide, which is in May, 1 day in May, and then some other minor reductions for a total of about $48.4 million in 10 for VDOT in administrative areas.
Ms. Buescher, if we could just go back 1 second again to board members have been away from this for about a month, but just to put the administrative reductions a little bit in context, like
yes,
we did with the overall revenue estimates, it might be helpful if you or the commissioner could just outline within the blueprint the extent and some examples of the administrative reductions already undertaken that these are on top of.
In other words, these are grouped in the three legs of the stool.
Correct. It is, let's see, as you recall, the biggest impact, I think, if I capitalize on that, you'll find under payroll reductions later in the agenda, either late this afternoon or tomorrow morning, I'll report on the results of the stage two layoff process. And so what you're seeing in here is the net savings that results from those layoffs that were accomplished in stage two and completed by November 1st of this year. So that, as you'll find out, is about 529 employees, a portion of their salaries that would have been spent the remainder of this year. So you get couple that with the furlough day, and the furlough day on its own, agency-wide, by the estimates I've seen, accounts for about $1.6 million for the department at our size.
And again, that's just to remind, these reductions are on top of the things that we've been talking about the last several months, the 1,000 full-time, 450 part-time that we've looked at in the budget, the closure of the residencies, half the equipment shops, things of that nature, which are administrative costs that we had embedded in the budget in June. These reductions are in addition to those.
Yes, sir. The second category, or the second leg of the stool, managed services and programs. I had mentioned that we reduced or flatlined the locality maintenance payments in 2010, and that saved us about $10 million. But this, from this base, though, we are looking to grow it outwards at 4%. We are proposing approximately a $45 million reduction in paving, in maintenance paving, But please remember, we had $110 million in ARRA paving projects recently. And in the bonus OA, we actually allocated approximately $9 million to a couple of paving projects. So we feel comfortable that at least in the short run, this is not a devastating reduction at this point. We had some operational improvements and corporate initiatives in the maintenance program that we saved some funding. We reduced some funding on. And as I said, additional funding from bonus OA, some of that went not only to the construction program, but some to the maintenance program. But this category had total estimated reductions of $51.6 million. The third category relates to what we call CTB program strategies, but more importantly, these relate to the six-year program. We did reduce, we had originally $50 million in the revenue sharing program, $15 million was state funding, and $35 million from CPR bonds. We had $40 million in applications. If you'll recall, you approved $40 million in projects. So we reduced $10 million of the state shortfall from this program based on the applications compared to the funding available. We also had, Mike Estes has brought to you before, some funding in the access programs where we had some funding return projects that couldn't be completed. So we're skipping a year of adding new money to the access program with the understanding it has enough money to still do an application process. We're just not adding to that program with an influx of new money in 10. But the surplus in that account will still allow an application process. We have the bonus OA, this and the open container. This is where you see the actual increase to the program and some other miscellaneous adjustments. So this category, even though there's a $17 million reduction in special funded programs, the net is an increase of 17. But this is where you see $82 million of the $94 million in 10, which is the reduction we had to find for all modes of transportation. This $82 million is VDOT's share of that.
And again, just if we could stay on that slide for a second, the managed services and program, these reductions are on top of, I believe it was about $40 million for mowing and the
absolutely
the closing
and
the of the rest
million
areas.
Over 6 years for rest areas.
Trying to think of some of the other direct services, safety service patrol. So again, this is on top of the previous reductions that you all approved in June.
This next slide is a lot of information, but it's the proposed revised allocations over the 6 years for all transportation modes to balance the loss of $851 million in revenues between 10 through 15. You can see the construction program over time, maintenance, toll facilities, that's a separate issue, assistance. Financial assistance to localities, administrative support, mass transit, aviation, and ports. This is the slide we will normally show when we're updating the Commonwealth Transportation Fund budget. This shows the program categories 10 through 15. And the total for the 6 years is $22.5 billion. This number, back when we adopted the original 9 through 14 budget, was $27.3. One thing I think is extremely important to talk about today is the use of the capital revenue bonds. The use of these CPR bonds has been constrained from the original intent envisioned when House Bill 3202 was passed. The original plans for the bonds provided significant funding for statewide and regional projects. And we started including CPR bonds in the six-year program in 2008. With the revenue reductions that we've experienced, the main focus of the bonds today are for transit and rail and matching federal funds. Just to refresh our memories, a minimum of 20% of the bond proceeds are to be used for transit capital, 4.3% for rail capital, and the remaining bond proceeds to match federal highway funds to contribute funding to revenue sharing and to pay or fund the cost of statewide or regional projects throughout the Commonwealth. In the 10 through 15 budget and six-year program, we're assuming an issuance of slightly less than $500 million at the end of fiscal year 10 and approximately $300 million in the out years. But we have two hurdles to cross: any future insurance premium revenue reductions, and as the state continues to lose state dollars, its debt capacity or its ability to issue debt declines. And we fall within the state's debt capacity with these CPR bonds. So if their capacity, because of their budget reductions, reduces to a certain point, our future bond issues may be in jeopardy in some fashion. So right now, bond proceeds, as you know, are necessary to fully match federal funds in every year of the budget. I'm sad to say that's the extent of my budget presentation at this point. We would bring back final numbers for you in December.
Mr. Lane.
Are we at our debt capacity now at the state level with the revenue projections in place?
I actually don't know what the latest revenue reductions does to their debt capacity, but I believe they have a cap of 5%. And I don't know with these reductions, and I believe the state's looking at that, whether they are at capacity or not.
Ms. Coulomb.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about one of the more disturbing parts of the presentation, which is on page 11, the numbers for the highway system construction. All of us should be concerned that in a state that continues to grow jobs and continues to grow population, that we have in the out years particularly a very rapidly declining set of numbers for highway systems construction, on top of what's a major diversion of construction dollars to maintenance. Do your figures reflect, for example, this on 11 and also on slide 4, the transfer of, what is it, projected this year, $500 million plus from the construction accounts
yes.
to the maintenance accounts?
Yes.
So the construction accounts are, say, on slide 4, are they losing $644 million in the 6 years, plus whatever's transferred to the maintenance fund, which over that time might be $3 billion?
I hate it when I can't put my hands on a... there's approximately a shift of $700 million in 10. That shift is two components. $500 million from the construction fund and then approximately $200 million in federal maintenance dollars that we've now diverted to the maintenance fund for those federally eligible activities. So it's approximately $700 million in 2010. So $500 million of the N10 is the cumulative of the construction funds that are will be transferred.
Okay, so this doesn't, the slide four doesn't really fully
That's
talk
correct.
About what's been taken.
That's correct. This is just the change.
The second question I have
10.
Is, it looks like in the out years under the current plan, slide 11, that actually debt service overtakes construction as a total part of the budget. Is that right? So by 2013, we're actually spending more on debt service than we are on construction.
You really need to add earmarks and special financing to the highway construction. That includes the bonds and other construction financing. But yes, on the face.
Mr. Chairman, that would be a very sad state of affairs for particularly the growing, rapidly growing parts of the Commonwealth. That sets up a whole lot of problems, no doubt about it, which just generically without regard to what the projects may be or what the solutions may be.
That's a powerful observation. Had not thought of it in that way, but debt service exceeding the bread and butter core construction programs is not a healthy threshold. I think, Ms. Busher, if I might ask you a couple of questions about the slide relating to the bonds on slide 14. The ability, as I understand the budget and then the six-year program, we have that presentation is heavily reliant on the House Bill 3202 bonds. And you're identifying some risk factors here that would include debt capacity that Mr. Lane has asked about, very real issue, or reductions in insurance premiums. What would happen if we were unable to issue the full amount of the bonds in any given year, at least over the life of the six-year program?
We have two options, not matching federal dollars or pulling money from the maintenance program back into the construction program as match.
So is it fair to say that we are deeply reliant on the issuance of those bonds and the amount that is shown, or
absolutely
we face the challenge? Again, they're used the major share for matching federal dollars, of leaving federal dollars on the table, or, again, that age-old dilemma we've talked about many times. And these risk factors are very, very significant going forward. And Mr. Lane's question, again, if the state is at debt capacity, that is something we will need to build into the plan. That's a contingency that has very, very significant implications for the entire architecture of the whole program. Mr. McCarthy.
Ms. Busher, HB 3202, was that 07 or 08 session?
07.
07.
To begin in 08.
And so we should have, had we the dollars from the revenue source, been able to start issuing bonds in 08.
Correct.
And we're not able to because the revenue wasn't there. Likewise for 09.
Because our existing outstanding debt service is the priority with those proceeds, and the increment didn't allow us to sell new bonds.
But you're hoping, if things don't get any worse, you're projecting $500 million of new bonds next year?
About $490 million, yes, okay. In July.
Okay. I'm just trying to get a fix on...
That's on the current lay of the land.
Right, which could continue to slide.
Mr. Chairman, in your role, obviously, is monitoring the General Assembly's ideas on these matters. Would it be appropriate to, would it be appropriate action, for example, given the very different circumstances in which the economy and these accounts find themselves now versus 2007, that perhaps these priorities that are in HB 3202 might be adjusted to better reflect some of the imbalances now that the gaps that really have opened up?
Possibly, but I think you still face the underlying issue of how do you match federal dollars. and that is the challenge
in other words,
going forward, whether it's maintenance or
well, you can't use bond funds for it to match maintenance dollars, but so that's the underlying challenge.
We've removed project money bonds on projects in the highway side. The last project that finishes with CPR bonds is in 11. And that forward, there's no, other than match, there's no federal, no bonds on highway projects. And then the next step we've taken is we're proposing to request budget language change to eliminate the revenue sharing component. So that brings us up to federal match and rail and public transportation.
So, Mr. Chairman, would I be correct then if, regardless of where matching federal funds is in the priority list, all the bond proceeds are needed to do that, so it doesn't matter what the other priorities might be if that's going to soak up all the bond proceeds?
It's a devil's dilemma. The transit and rail commitments typically are federalized programs as well, so the match money for the Metro Matters program is embedded in there. The transit capital is the non-federal, the state share of the non-federal portion, so it's rare that you actually have a project that does not have a federal component to it. I don't think mixing or matching those categories would dramatically change the demand. We don't have enough state dollars to adequately match federal funds. And if we don't hit the target because you have maximized the use of those bonds, we have a very difficult situation just maintaining what is in this very skinny program.
I keep thinking, Mr. Chairman, of the wimpy character in Popeye. I will gladly pay you Tuesday for a transportation system today.
Any other questions of Ms. Busher?
Scott Warren, Mr. Chairman. On the website, the administrative budget for VDOT's listed at about $434 million.
Mm-hmm.
Have these changes
not
been
yet
reflected? So it's not in that. So, okay.
Okay. The next item is scheduled to be the six-year improvement program. Mr. Dickens has asked that we delay until we get here. We'll move on to item number four, which is the transportation enhancement program policy. You should have at your places. I started to receive a large number of emails around this morning that were intended for the entire CTB. This is about a third of the emails that arrived today. So there's a very robust conversation around this. Welcome, Mr. Estes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Thank you for the opportunity to continue our journey and dialogue on this interesting issue that we started in June. My goal today is to basically cover the feedback that we received since our September workshop presentation and then talk about an action plan forward. Before I do that, I want to very quickly kind of review where we've been and what, again, the program entails. I won't spend a lot of time on the upfront things. You've seen this before. But just a reminder of what the enhancement program is, the mandatory set-aside, our current CTB policy. On the program, you know, we get about $15 to $20 million a year that the board does allocate to projects where we receive about 150 to 200 applications. The board funds around 100 projects each year. Really the problem statement that we brought to you in June was kind of the program status of the large number of projects that are active and underway. You can see here the numbers of those. Basically, Virginia lags behind other states in our reimbursement level, and that's due largely to the number of existing projects that are underway, and that's really the problem we're trying to address on the proposed changes we've been discussing as a group. So back in June, we brought this simple kind of one-slide proposal about what our goal was from a staff perspective, and that was to focus the resources on completing those existing projects. We did talk to the board about trying to, again, focus any new money that's put on new projects on core transportation functions. That's mainly your bicycle pedestrian amenities as well as streetscape improvements. The bottom line was we simply wanted to propose to the board that we modify the policy to better enable projects to reach completion. As part of that, back in August, we surveyed all of you, members of the board. And in September, we shared with you the results of that survey. And I want to, again, share my appreciation with the board for taking the time to do that. Basically, from the survey results, a great response. a lot of support for some of the proposals, some obviously some strong feelings about some modifications we need to make. So we brought that back to the board in September. I want to quickly review the kind of the tiered approach that we brought back in September that we were talking about hopefully implementing. And that was what I call the tier one, was things that we can implement immediately. As you know, we have new applications coming in December 1st for the next round, and our proposal was to increase the minimum allocation from the current CTV policy of 25% for each proposed project to 50%. We also proposed that we would fully fund any projects selected by the board members that were to cost $200,000 or less. And again, that was to try to, as one board member told me, to try to get in and get done, get these projects, these small projects done. The second tier that we talked about in September was to, again, to focus on the existing projects, was to only take applications next year, December 1st, 2010, for those that are existing projects. Again, we've got around 350 existing projects, and we have to feel like there's an adequate pool out there of good projects that we can help fund and bring to fruition. The more interesting aspect of the proposal that we'll talk about in a little bit more detail in just a second was about the proposal to focus the categories to four categories, what we call our focus on core transportation. As a reminder, there are 12 eligible categories in the enhancement program. So this was trying to focus that energy on more of the movement of people as part of the program. So we'll talk about the feedback that we got back mainly on that aspect. So again, after the September workshop, we went out and called for feedback about over a 30-day period, went through our website, targeted emails to localities. I sent localities personally, or emails personally to all localities across the state, as well as the Association of Counties, Municipal League. And then, of course, we focused on our normal special interest groups, we'll call them, that come to us every year, come to you every year, looking for allocations through the enhancement program. And then we were in the midst of doing enhancement workshops around the state, so we made sure we communicated through that venue as well. So here's what we received back over that 30-day period. 14 comments. So you can see the breakdown here, anywhere from localities to state agencies, PDCs, citizens, and special interest groups. Majority or nine of those comments were supportive, with really no additional changes suggested of the, what I called again, the tiered proposals that we presented. But five had comments that were focused on those, again, those limiting those categories. Talk about that for a quick minute. Before we do that, again, going back to the tier level, what our hope is and what we presented in September was to potentially get an action by the board at tomorrow's action meeting to modify the policy. And you have a resolution in your package that you received to do that. Again, based on the feedback we received and the survey from the board, we do recommend going forward with the Tier 1 approach and the Tier 2 approach that I've talked about. And that's 25%, changing that to 50%, the $200,000 or less again, and then limiting the applications to existing projects only next year. We've made one slight change to the categories based on the feedback from since September. Again, based on the five folks who suggested that we change our approach on that, most of them were focused on historic preservation, and I'm assuming some of you have probably heard from some of the special interest groups as well. Basically, we feel like we can accommodate, if not in whole, at least partially, some of those concerns by adding the rehabilitation of historic transportation building structures or facilities. It does bring a historic element back to it, opens up the categories a little bit, but does still focus mainly on more directly tied transportation facilities. So therefore, that's what part of our recommendation is, and what hopefully you'll see in the resolution that we presented, is to go forward with adding just that one category to the four we had previously discussed with the board in June and September. I wanted to make it very clear, though, because I do think that this is an important action that we're asking the board to consider, of what this does and what it doesn't do, if you were to consider taking action on that resolution tomorrow. I emphasize new projects. I want to kind of spend a minute on this slide. New projects in this slide, because again, our focus is on completing existing projects. So even if you have an existing project that's not in one of those five categories, that project is still eligible for funds. until we get those projects done. Again, our goal is to get those projects done. So if the board members feel those are prudent and necessary projects to complete, then obviously we would encourage that to be our focus as we get those existing projects off the table. So our limiting to the categories is not to existing projects. What we are looking at is that when we start taking on new projects 2 years from now, that we look at focusing that money on those five categories. So when you do that, I want to be very clear with the board what the intent or what the ramification would be. So this is a list of examples. I know every one of you has some of these or several of these in all of your districts or in your region that you're probably likely to hear about back on. So again, this would be for new projects in these categories, whether it's acquisitions of battlefield sites, visitor centers, historic highway programs. Mr. Secretary, you had mentioned the highway market program. That's an existing program. So as long as that's a continued existing program, that would be eligible under the existing program. But future projects or programs like that would not be eligible. Historic inns, taverns, or anything basically in historic preservation that's not tied to that Category 7 that we're suggesting adding, which is that restoration of historic transportation structures. And then again, museums like the Schooner Virginia, for example, was classified as a museum. So I wanted to make sure we were clear about what we were talking about with that, and I would like to then talk about next steps. Again, our goal from day one, from September, was to possibly have a resolution passed by the board tomorrow, and we'd still like the board to consider that, and then we would move forward with our communication plan and getting the word out for those changes. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back to you for questions.
Questions, Mr. Estes. This is an action item on tomorrow morning's agenda. Mr. Davies.
Yes. Where would you put the journey through Hallett Ground? In this? Is it a highway program, or is it, where does it fit?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Davies, the journey through Hallett Ground, mainly they've been pursuing National Scenic Byway grant money for a lot of what their work is. But one of the things that I'm quite positive they've been talking to you about and they've been talking to us about is doing some corridor improvements along there for what we call scenic beautification along the corridor. That would fall under the category that we still are retaining. Let's see if I can pull that up here. On scenic beautification along corridors. That's the third bullet that we have. So I do think that a lot of what this journey through Hallett Ground is trying to accomplish can still fit at least part of it in one of the categories we're presenting.
Would it include covering signage and display boards?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Davis, I do think that there is a separate category on outdoor advertising as far as if they're wanting to eliminate or reduce along the corridor. That would not be eligible under this proposal. It would be more along the proposal that they're kicking around on planting trees, again, corridor preservation and beautification for that entire stretch of facility from, as you know, all the way up to our northern border.
Mr. Chairman, would it also cover scenic pull-offs, things of that nature?
It would not. Scenic pull-offs are, let me pull up. Bear with me just one second. Scenic pull-offs, I believe, are going to be in the Category 4, which we are not including. This was our kind of a throw-in slide at the end to talk about the 12 categories, which is the scenic highway programs and the tourist welcome center. So we're not closing the pull-offs.
And, Mr. Chairman, another question. It's my understanding if we vote on this tomorrow, then we're going to communicate this and they're going to be prepared to submit their application December 1. Based on our communications on an action we take tomorrow?
Well, again, Mr. Davies, the intent is that the Tier 1 would only apply to the applications coming in December. So that would be everything is still eligible under these 12 categories that are coming in December. We didn't feel it was fair, to be quite blunt with you, to try to change it midstream because folks are working on their applications as we speak, as we were having this dialogue. The two things that we think we can change that won't affect the eligibility is the actual allocation of the dollars once we receive those applications. And that's increasing that rule of 25% minimum to 50%, and then also applying the new rule of the $200,000 or less to any of those applications in December. The tightening of the categories would actually not come into play until FY13, so we've got several years before that comes into play.
Mr. McCarthy.
Ms. Chesky, so this next round, any project that fits those 12 and is an already existing project that we have funded is all we can consider this go-round? No new projects?
Actually, Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Chairman, Mr. McCarthy, I'll go back to this slide here. We are actually not going to ask the board to limit it to only existing projects this round. Again, we didn't get the word out under our applicant workshops in the spring. And we know, and you know, that the applicants and the sponsors work over months to work through the details with you, with their local governments, with their support letters from different elected officials. And we didn't want to change the program midstream. So it can be open for new or existing projects in any 12 category. We're only asking the board to limit it to existing projects only next December, so we can have the whole year to get the word and the message out that we're only taking existing projects. So I'll give you an example. If someone comes in with a new project December 1st of 2009, and you decide to award them an allocation next year, then that'll be considered an existing project
next
for the next round, and they'll be eligible for that tightening that we're talking about.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Estes, would you be kind enough to illustrate or illuminate for me a little bit more on the rationale into including historic transportation buildings and eliminating transportation museums? Without the benefit of having read this bunch of emails here, I hate to think in terms of five people with an interest in a old train station or something, while you might have a legitimate transportation museum, it's really a much better use of the funds going on. So, and just thinking in terms of the structure for the historical transportation building versus the structure and what's in the transportation museum. I was just trying to get in my mind the good reasons for one without the other.
Sure. Let me, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Martin, if I go back to my 12 categories. The reason we added, if we could look at this one real quick, category what we call Category 7. Again, these are the categories as described by Federal Highway. These are the 12 eligible categories. When we got the comments back, I'll give you two examples of projects that would now be eligible underneath that category that I think still fit our goal from June of core transportation. One would be, even within VDOT, they came to me and said, hey, we have historic bridges out there that are carrying traffic today or could be used for pedestrian facilities that are eligible under that category, that instead of using other money to rehab those bridges, we can tap into the enhancement program to rehab an existing bridge that's designated historic. So we have about 30 in the state, and that would be a resource to help address our bridge problem. Another good example is in Mr. White's district in Lynchburg, for example, the Kemper Street Station that I think a lot of you have heard about lately. You know, that's an actual active facility for the new train service. It's also being funded under the enhancement program because of the historic nature of that building that it's being functioned in. So it's being an active core transportation facility still today. So that's why when we looked at that, we took note of those two examples and said, okay, it makes sense to include that and add that based on the comments we received, and that's why it's part of the suggestion today.
Okay, well, my question was as much or more on the rationale. Now, the structures, I understand, no problem with the structures, mm-hmm. but the building, the rationale for the building for historic buildings, but not for transportation museums.
Right. Apologize, Mr. Martin, for not fully answering the question. The intent was the tie to the historic structure could still be a tie to movement of people, whereas the museum is it is more tied to restoration of a historic building and or communication of a museum-type environment. And so, again, our focus from our goal from day one was from the core transportation, so that's why we did not expand it to the museum part.
Ms. Coulney.
Mr. Chairman, I have questions about that same category being added back in for a different reason. The cost structure of facilities and structures and so forth is really very different than trails and pedestrian facilities and some other things. And it's, at least it's my experience, I wanted to ask you about it, that these usually piece together grants and monies from various programs, both at the state and federal level, often match with local funds. In other words, there are plenty of other pots of money that are being used in this area, and very often our piece is some discrete, small, not that it's not important, but it really doesn't make the difference in the project. I worry that that it takes money directly out of these other transportation, more direct transportation categories, and I think some of the confusion you were talking about, like why one building and not another building. In fact, a building's a building, and the economics of the building tend to be large. And I wonder if that's not going to cause confusion in the future, but also sort of fight with our minimum allocation requirement. I mean, a million-dollar project by definition is going to need to get $500,000. We don't expect to have large allocations as individual members of the board. It's going to be very hard for us to consider things that sort of soak all the money up for a year or for 2 years or 3 years in some cases. So I understand that you did get some suggestions about it, but is it your impression that those projects just wouldn't get done if somehow we didn't unable to put money in?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kuhlman, a great question, a tough one. I think it'd be a little speculative on my part to really answer that. But you've hit the nail on the head. It will obviously, the more you expand it, the more the tougher choices will be on you, on the board, to again focus that energy. And again, we present kind of what we heard, and if the board would like to go back to the other four or have different thoughts, we're obviously open to whatever the board would like to do.
Well, I think either way that we determine this, Mr. Chairman, that I would say we've done a good job in narrowing our focus to something that we're more likely to be able to follow through on in a good way.
That's what today's meeting is all about, is narrowing focus. Anybody on this side, comments
over here? Mr. Davies and then Mr. McCarthy.
The projects that we presently have underway, when I talked to you, said we're going to get a list of those. I know there's concern among some of the existing people about where they are in the process, and I haven't seen anything recently on that.
Excellent.
So I think that would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Davies, absolutely. Mr. Davies and I kind of communicated via email yesterday. I think I mentioned this before. Staff is putting together an exhaustive list of every project in your districts, how much allocation has been on since the day one of the program, the status of the project, how much has been reimbursed or billed to the department, and we absolutely want to get that to you soon, and we had planned to get that to you as part of the application round, the next round of applications. So when you look at those existing projects, you can then see the progress that's either being made or in some cases not being made. And we're very aggressively moving forward with trying to highlight projects that we think are kind of not moving along as they should. And I think the board is aware of our deallocation process that we implemented about a year and a half ago to try to do that, to bring money off of projects that aren't moving forward to that pot of what you're looking at for other projects as part of the application process.
Okay, we'll Mr. McCarthy, and then we need to move on. We're going to take up the six-year program right at 3:30.
Can you give me the rationale? Number one, pedestrian and bicycle facilities. Terrific idea, core transportation function. Number two, safety and education with respect thereto. What's the rationale for that over a couple of other possibilities that might have been kept in? I didn't know that we did safety and education programs as part of this. I certainly don't recall doing any in my district.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Mr. McCarthy, it's very rare. We have one every couple of years, and we just felt that those categories could almost be blended together, so we didn't want to exclude the safety and education but still promote pedestrian and bicycle improvements. So we have very few of those, but we didn't see the need to take those off the table because they're so tied closely to the bike and pedestrian facilities.
So it's not that versus some other one, that, like number three, for example, I think is directly related to the transportation system, whereas you could easily combine those first two and not, by your own mistake, and not miss much in the way of safety and education activities.
Correct.
Is that something that we could still do?
Again, Mr. McCarthy, the 12 are very defined from the Federal Highway Administration of what those 12 individual categories are, and all their directions comes from those 12 categories. So in Fed speak, they'll talk about category 1 or category 6. So that's why we've always kind of based it on what they define as the categories and then tried to narrow that in our discussions here.
If you want to add one to that one.
Yeah, okay. I think I would like to see us consider adding number 3 because I do think it's relevant and it's an area where Virginia is a real leader in scenic and historic easements around the country. We've probably got the most impressive easement program in the country in this state, and I can't see us walking away from that if we have federal funds to enhance that program. So I would encourage us to try to add that one in.
Okay, well, tomorrow during the action item, that's an amendment to be offered.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments on the presentation? If not, then let's just see how we're doing on time. We've got 5 more minutes before we're going to start the 6-year program. Do you think you could do your other 2 items in 5 minutes, Mr. Estes?
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman.
We can go back to the previous item if you like.
I would prefer that we move ahead, sir. All right. Tomorrow we're going to have 4 action items for the board to consider in the access road programs. The first one's going to be a deallocation. I didn't want to spend a lot of time on that in Alamo County. Basically, that was a project that the board allocated money back in 2004 that did not come to fruition. The county is on board with the with us deallocating those funds. I do want to spend a few minutes on the 3 projects that are new projects. I'll start with the one in Halifax County. As you can see here, this is an economic development access project. It's under the bonded concept, which means that the county will put up a bond to protect the investment from the board. The county plans to administer this, and we'll be asking the board to allocate $500,000 out of the Economic Development Access Program for this project. The next one is in Southampton. It's also an Economic Development Access Road project. It's the first phase of a development down there. It's also under the bonded concept, which the board's familiar with. The county will be administering that project. It's estimated to be estimated cost of about $800,000. So we'll be asking for the maximum amount from the board, and we'll show you a chart of that here in just a second as well for that project. The third one is switching from economic development access to recreational access down in Scott County. This is the Daniel Boone Wilderness Trail Interpretive Center, and we'll be asking the board for an allocation for that project as well. This is a fairly substantial project with a lot of different funding sources, so when you see the estimate on this, just know that the Recreational Access Road Fund is just a portion of the funding for that project. So you can see just the breakdown, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, of what we'll be asking for new allocations to the board for action tomorrow.
Okay. Questions of Mr. Estes? All great projects, particularly the one near International Paper in Franklin. That's a very, very important job project. Speaking of which, we have Mr. Dickens has joined us just recently from the greater Franklin area.
Just left there.
And we're just now perfect timing getting ready to start the 6-year program presentation item number 3. Ms. Busher and Mr. Pittard will be making that presentation. We'll take a short break at the conclusion of the 6-year program discussion.
Good afternoon again. I'll start off with some initial comments that pertain to both highway and rail and public transportation. Then I'll speak specifically to highway, and then Mr. Pittard will come up for the remainder of the presentation. The revised 10 through 15 6-year improvement program implements the policy that we talked to you about at the last meeting to eliminate the distribution of federal SDP formula to the localities. It also includes the reduced transit operating funds based on formula, the rural and small urban reductions offset by flexed ARRA funds. Steve will speak to that. State transit capital grants have been reduced. We're proposing the elimination, as I mentioned, of the revenue sharing program in fiscal year 12 forward. And as we talked about earlier, we have approximately $1.9 billion programmed of capital project revenue bonds. And that's from 2008 through 2015, not just 10 through 15. Bonds are necessary throughout the program's life to fully match federal dollars and available state debt capacity and insurance premium revenues determine our ability to utilize the authority given to us by House Bill 3202. So that sort of sets the stage for what we've had to do in this update to the 10 through 15 program.
Mr. Chairman, I was under the impression that the revenue sharing program was a legislatively mandated program. Is that not true?
Ms. Davis, it is, like many things authorized in state code, there are two components to it. There is something that's been around for a number of years, which is if available, the CTB may allocate $15 million. We have a program that for many years has exceeded $15 million. Then on top of that, there is the bonds of $25 million. So the lion's share of the revenue sharing program for the last 2 years has been from the CPR bonds. The bonds are gone. We need those for federal match and to meet the transit and rail commitments. So we're down to the $15 million, and there are many things that are prescribed in code but are subject to annual appropriation. We will be putting language into the budget or seeking that language in the budget in order to make clear that that program is not one that can continue. We can't afford it. And if we only have $15 million, for example, then it gets prorated among the jurisdictions, and it's just not an effective program.
Mr. Chairman, I'm really concerned about that. I know there may not be any alternative, but I'd sure like for us to explore some way to keep that program alive. It generates that much money again at the localities, and it addresses some of the most important local issues that are taking place in the Commonwealth. And it just seems like a real shame for us not to try to find a way to keep that program alive so that when funding comes back, that some of those issues can be addressed. It generates self-help. It's really a model program, in my opinion, and has been. I understand when you don't have any choice of anything left to cut. But it'd sure be nice to figure out how to keep the authorization and the concept alive.
Well, the authorization will remain, and when and if funding expands, obviously, that would be a candidate for expansion. These are the tough, very difficult discussions we've had here about closing half the maintenance facilities and a third of the residencies and 19 rest areas around the state and 1,400 layoffs, and this is just part of it. And so if you even look at the choices for today, for example, transit operations, you'll see a little bit. These are state 100% state dollars, and so this affects all of the funding available for the other state-funded programs, and what we're trying to simply do is to maintain some semblance of responsibility towards our core responsibilities, and as laid out in the code and the Appropriation Act, it's maintenance and operations of transit, rail, and highways, and it's matching federal dollars. When we talked about the bonds, we're teetering on the edge of not fully matching federal dollars. And when you look at the maintenance allocations, particularly to secondary and urban highways, we are not meeting our full set of obligations there. This is a difficult choice. The other factor to consider, this year we've seen a pretty sharp drop-off in local government applications. There may be even less. I suspect there will be next year, so we just don't know how well subscribed the program will be. But your point about matching dollars is a extremely valid one.
Excuse me, but I understood you to say that the authorization would still be there. It would just be budget language that would change the requirements that we do it this coming year. But if the board and an administration wanted to take it up 2 years from now, it would still be authorized to do it.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Dickens.
Mr. Chairman, the reference to bonds necessary throughout the program's life to fully match federal funds was followed by provided there are revenues there to pay for them and we haven't exceeded the state's debt capacity. Are we at risk here of not being able to make our federal match?
Must be the Hampton Roads question.
We did have that discussion earlier, Mr. Dickens. No, that's okay because this is very important. This is kind of like the keystone of a very carefully pieced together without any mortar type of program. And the CPR bonds are essential to meeting contractual obligations for transit and rail, which are federal, and then also the matching the federal highway funds. If we hit debt capacity, and no one knows the answer to that today, that is dependent on the overall condition of state revenues, is one issue. A second is if the insurance premium taxes fall below projected levels. That is probably the single most critical issue in this very scaled-down six-year program. And an inability to sell the full amount of bonds that are programmed will have ripple effects many times beyond that.
Mr. Chairman, one final comment I'd like to make. I think you're right in terms of the efficiencies of allocating $15 million through a formula that leaves just such small amounts of money that it's difficult. But I think Dr. Davis has put his finger on something. It's not just there's things that localities need done. It's that part of the program was really to encourage a growth in vision and expertise and management at the local level so that they could become a better builder of their own transportation systems, a better understanding of how that all works. And a large part of our recommendations on local land use tying with transportation assumes there's a partnership between the state and a locality in looking at growth and development and land use patterns and transportation networks that are necessary to make things work. You know, I worry that it's not just the money. When you look at the money, it's clear argument. But when you look at those larger questions, we're beginning to undermine a larger set of initiatives that I think we've all been proud to have been a part of putting in place. Stay with me a second. Newton's second law of physics is force equals mass times acceleration. It also works in the negative. If you're decelerating effort, the reduced force shows up immediately, and the impact you're able to have to influence these larger and wider questions really dries up very quickly. I think that may be an unintended or unacknowledged consequence of what we're being forced to do here within a very strict framework of limited resources and limited opportunities to make changes. And while this one probably isn't necessarily the big thing to hang all those questions on, it's an example of how we're undoing a larger vision of how we think things ought to proceed to the benefit of the overall Commonwealth, not just of a single locality and so forth. So I'm with you on that. There's a set of larger questions here that if we're not careful, we may set back. I mean, you can't turn on and off a locality's intentions or expertise or plans and so forth. It's really very, very difficult. I don't really like this being such an uncertain partner.
If I may, and Dr. Davis, if you want to add to that, as we have talked about for over a year, the change in transportation funding is fundamentally changing the state and local relationship. It remains to be seen if that will be also true in educational funding and in human services. The whole fabric of state and local relationships is under tremendous stress right now as a consequence of the revenue reductions. We're seeing our particular version of that. And again, from a overall perspective with a small pot of money trying to allocate it to 185 county cities and towns, you don't aggregate that into anything meaningful, and we've learned that. But your larger point here, whether it's revenue sharing, whether it's street maintenance payments to localities, whether it's operational reimbursements for transit, the reliability of the state as a partner of localities is being called into question, and the relationship is undoubtedly changing, probably not in a positive way.
Mr. Chairman, that was the second thing that I wanted to say. I noticed the reduced transit operating funds based on formula, and I realized that probably ridership and numbers are much lower, but I see a particular category selected for being moved to flex ARRA funds, which run out in 2 years, which means in 2 years there will not be any money at all for rural and small urban transit systems, and I really wonder what a CTB board is going to be looking at when they realize those funds are gone and there's no longer any service in those areas for handicapped people, for people that the only way they have to go to the grocery store or the doctor or whatever else. And I just asked the question of why that one category was picked out of all of the transit operating funds that are available to be put on ARA. Is that simply because that's the most opportune one? Or why couldn't larger urban areas been switched so that it wouldn't come back to the fact that in 2 years you're going to have a category that will have no funding at all?
And Mr. Badger, you want to respond to that?
Mr. Chairman, we control some federal funds strictly for small urban and rural areas, so we had the authority to make this transfer over to operating. The large systems had the ability to make that decision themselves. But since we control the rural and small urban funds, we did that. And by the way, those funds are only for 1 year, so the impact will be felt in next summer, in fiscal year 2011. And our transit systems are aware of that, and they're going to deal with it as best they can.
Okay, we haven't even gotten into the details. Mr. Davis.
Did I understand correctly, there was no option for the large urban areas to share by going under the, or they had already used their funds?
Mr. Chairman, they were given funds directly by the Federal Transit Administration. They had the opportunity to make that decision.
Thank you.
All right, I'll get into some of the specifics in the highway program. The principles that were used to update the 10 through 15 program, as we said before, was to maximize the use of our federal funds. Second, we needed to keep funded project phases that were underway, as well as project phases that would start in the federal fiscal year 2010 to meet our 2010 federal strategy as well. As I mentioned before, we eliminated the formula distribution of federal STP funds, and what we did instead was concentrated those funds to advance project phases to completion. Now, these are funds that don't go to the large MPO or urban localities. This is for localities with population less than 200,000. So we brought those in and centrally allocated those funds to projects that could keep project phases funded and moving forward.
Mr. Chairman, my question to Rita, is that a temporary elimination of the formula concept? And if funds were available 2 years from now, we could go back to a formula distribution?
Part of the difficulty here isn't necessarily funding availability. Our problem is making sure that we can obligate those federal funds timely, so that we maximize the use of federal dollars every year. And when they get distributed out by population to localities, they become such small amounts, they don't move project phases forward, and therefore we can't obligate them and use them in the year in which we need to meet federal, each year we must meet federal strategy. But if they sit on projects accumulating and we can't obligate those projects, then I'm not using or maximizing my federal dollars.
I understand that. I guess there's not a restriction on dreams, and the dream we would have that adequate funding could be available to take care of all of them.
Sure.
Has this totally been eliminated as a a formula for distribution of the STP funds for the future, or is this a temporary thing?
It's in for this 6-year program. That is the method we're using. We're bringing it in.
But could be revisited, and this is a discretionary choice of the Commonwealth Transportation Board, and a little bit of history I think is in order here. The formula that's being referred to here is a state allocation formula for primary, secondary, and urban. It was originally intended to allocate state funds. There have been zero state dollars for about 2 years in that formula because we're transferring it out of construction and putting it into maintenance. There had been, beginning in the late 1990s, in an effort to support some of the primary, secondary, and urban construction program, federal funds that were, because there is a separate federal formula, but sort of run through that local formula. It showed up when a county did their secondary hearing, or a city or a town, their urban hearing. And over time, those funds have been diminishing and getting spread thinner and thinner, and they don't, again, the point is no individual 185 localities for a small amount of money, you don't aggregate that into a project that gets into construction, so the money sat and does not get used, and we're at the point now with use it or lose it and leaving federal dollars on the table. The methodology here is virtually identical to what we did with the stimulus program. So there are distribution formulas that are set by the federal government, largely population-based, and what the VDOT staff has tried to do is within that formula is find whole projects that can be brought to construction. And so if you remember, for example, in the stimulus project, the Narrows Bridge, that was a project that was done under the federal funding formulas. Would never, ever happen under the state funding formulas because it just spreads too little too far.
Mr. Chairman, what assumption have we made about the Federal Highway Fund for the 6-year plan? Have we assumed that we will receive funds in a range that we typically have received? Because it's my understanding that the fund is basically gone unless it is reconstituted. And I'm just curious, if we're building a strategy that's going to use federal fund match as our primary strategy for doing road work in the Commonwealth, and that those funds aren't available, it seems to me that might raise a huge concern.
I think Ms. Buescher has several slides on that very topic in a little bit, but a great question.
So what was funded when we updated and reviewed the 10 through 15 program? Again, we looked for projects to meet federal strategy. We covered increased estimates on projects that were underway or, again, as I indicated, phase starts in federal fiscal 10. And we looked at funding bridges on the interstate, primary, secondary, and urban systems. I've just listed three, Jefferson Park in Charlottesville, Route 29 in Pennsylvania, and I-81 in Montgomery County. So when we reduced or moved funding off projects, what we looked for was what would help us maximize federal dollars by accumulating those funds on project phases, covering increases on underway projects to keep contracts going, and then looking at the bridges that are on the chief engineer's structurally deficient list and already in the program. So we did shift some of those funds, especially the STP funding, and we shuffled those into the primary, secondary, and urban bridges. And those I've just listed as three examples. And we also looked at projects supporting economic competitiveness. We looked at and funded I-564. We have funding on the Midtown PPTA. We have commitments on I-95, 395 PPTA, and I-495 PPTA that's underway. Um, I like this slide in that it kind of in a nutshell gives you a picture, and I'm continuing to show it from a historical perspective forward. We are basically looking at a flatlining of the program between the approved and the revised. Now, some of the changes that we talked about is a shifting of funds from one set of projects to another set of projects that will move those projects forward, funding fewer phases and fewer projects by moving funds from one place to another. One of the big funding losses that we did have, though, is in revenue sharing, which I talked about earlier. And those projects aren't actually in these numbers in the program. They're separate, specially funded projects. So they're not, the cuts in that program over the 6-year period are not reflected in these numbers. So we are still at approximately $5.5 billion in our program. But what you'll see is there's been some shifting between secondary and urban specifically, where the STP formula funds were accumulated, pulled in, and then put back to cover bridges in the various categories. And then we've put money on interstate and primary bridges. To speak a little bit to the question I believe that Mr. Davis had a moment ago, we all know that Congress is still working on legislation for the Highway Trust Fund authorization for 10 forward. The existing authorization has expired, and we are working on a continuing resolution that also expires December 18th. So we're taking this a couple months at a time, and we don't know how long it'll take or what it'll look like when it's done. But what we did, if you'll recall, is when we reduced the program, the 9 through 14 program, we established what we call a Federal Reserve. And today that equates to approximately $627 million, which includes the match, that could become available for programming if we get a resolution or a reauthorization that supports that level of federal funding. But if it doesn't, we have not over-programmed. We have cushioned potentially a reduction, cushioned ourselves for potential federal reduction, not knowing what the new authorization will look like in terms of totals for us. Now, if funds should become available, we could recommend that those funds be aggregated and used on a handful of projects, key projects, that might include mandatory regional STP, CMAC, and enhancement and safety programs. Now, I say that at the top because this reserve does have the normal mandatory allocations for CMAC and STP. There's always, they take a portion off the top of what we get in our federal allocation for safety, HCIP, CMAC, and RSTP funding. So those would still go to those programs. But we could look at the Midtown Tunnel PPTA project enhancement and project oversight. The I-95, 395 PPTA project oversight, Route 460 PPTA project enhancement. We have the Coalfields Expressway PPTA project and the high-speed rail project. So those are some things that are economic development projects that are a handful of projects that we might want to consider if that reserve is or does become available.
If I could, just a little historical note, as Mr. Davies and Mr. White and Mr. Bowie will recall, and to your question, Dr. Davis, this was a common practice to program what people hope for in the way of federal funding. We had, as I recall, in April of 2002, about $2.7 billion in phony revenues built into the six-year program and projects that would never be built, funding that would never become available. This is a very different approach that says when and if the federal government actually appropriates and makes a solid commitment to these funds, then and only then will they be programmed.
You do have in your information, in your notebooks, the projects from which funding was removed. What you don't have, what you actually have in the rest of your document, is where that funding was replaced to, was put to. So it's a combination. The document, we just wanted to show you where funding was pulled, and you'll see that the secondary and urban took the larger hits, mainly because of concentrating the STP funds on bridges and pulling those back in. But it's basically a flatline construction program at this point, the revision.
Any other questions, Ms. Buescher, before we hear from the DRP team? Mr. Pittard, Mr. McCarthy.
I just want to say, Mr. Chairman, that $5.5 billion program is approximately, what, $5 billion or more short of back in July of 2002 when some of us first started allocating some of it.
About that, if you go back to the summer of 2007, which would have been FY 2008, program was about $8.5-9 billion.
Yeah.
So in the space of 18 months, it's declined, what, 40%?
I feel like the leprechaun who got back to his camp and found that somebody took a lot of his fucking gold away.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. When we use the word enhancement, are we simply... does that mean more than more additional funds? Does that mean additional project definition or scope? Or?
Additional funds on those projects.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Pittard, welcome.
Thank you, Rita. Thank you, Chairman. I'll briefly take you through the revisions required based on the new revenue estimates we received in November for state funds. And first, just give you a high-level summary of the impacts. The revenue reductions are fund-specific, meaning not all fund sources were impacted. Primarily, it's the Mass Transit Trust Fund and the Rail Enhancement Fund that saw reductions from this past June's approved program through early November, the new revised estimate. The capital reductions impact projects that had Mass Transit Trust funds allocated to them and not the projects that had the CPR bonds allocated to them. Finally, as we spoke on earlier, all of transit operations we'll see has been impacted. We were able to reallocate, flex some of the ARRA funds, the $30 million of ARRA funds that were under our control. We were able to take 10% of those based on a presidential action with the ARRA funds and allocate those towards operating costs versus capital cost, which in turn limited the impact on our rural and small urban providers that they will not have to suffer a loss as a result of this decrease. However, our large urban providers will be losing 5.7%, as you'll see later in my slide, and they have the option to potentially do the same thing we've done, which would be to convert their operating capital funds to operating or to make up that difference with their local funding. Additionally, a point going forward for next year, and this, once again, Mr. Davis gets towards your point earlier, for FY11, all operation providers, you know, both rural, small urban, large urban, will see about a 7% decline from the number that they were awarded in June. Basically, what we're seeing is the impacts of the recession, and in particular the fund sources and the impacts there. You know, the Mass Transit Trust Fund, about half of those dollars come from general sales tax, and then the remaining half is fees and taxes related to vehicles and fuels. Obviously, those items are down. Additionally, we have recordation taxes related to sales of homes, which are way off, which go towards transit operations. We have a decline in the underlying insurance premium tax revenues that have had the impact that Ms. Busher spoke on our CPR bonds. And finally, the Rail Enhancement Fund, which receives vehicle rental taxes, has also been impacted as people are obviously renting fewer vehicles these days. Just a couple of soundbite bullets. Going back to June of 2008 and the six-year program we presented then, and looking at the projected number for the year we're in, fiscal year 2010. So just, and I'm not talking the six-year period, I'm just talking about the year we're in now. In just under 18 months, we've lost 22% of our transit revenues, or $38 million. And 20% of our rail revenues. So to reiterate what the chairman was just pointing out, the last 18 months, that significant decline has really been enlightened there. Next, I guess this is a point I've brought up numerous times before, but the recordation taxes, when they were approved in 2007, they were estimated to be around $45 million a year, and the current estimate, it's actually surpassed the 50% level of decrease at $22.3 million. And probably the another point to make here is when these revenues were dedicated to transit operations, we had hoped to provide about 55% of the eligible cost of transit operations, and with this current reduction, we've fallen below 40%. Additionally, we talked about the CPR bonds, the minimum amounts to both transit and rail. And then this number differs a little from the number that Rita showed, but this is basically saying that originally we thought that we could issue the $3 billion in bonds, I think through 2008 through 2017, $300 million a year. And maybe it's 2018, but the point being is through 2017, the commitments that we're projecting to date, you know, that's taking out the state of good repair match for WMATA, taking out the federal match that VDOT has, taking out our transit allocations and our rail allocations, that through 2017, we're looking at about $2.4 billion in allocations, and we have about that amount in bonding capacity. But that's
a quick question.
Yes.
The recordation tax and the, what is the insurance premium that supports the bonds? Which insurance is that again?
I may be wrong, but I believe it's on all insurance.
Not non-health.
Non-health.
So homeowners, policies,
automobiles.
And does any of that recordation tax go to support these bonds too, or is that
no?
And what is that exactly dedicated to, the recordation tax?
Well, it used to be about $200 million. It's down to about $100 million plus or minus. $40 million of that supports the Route 58 program. $40 million goes back to the localities where it originated, and then the equivalent of 5 cents, or is it three cents, goes to transportation. So that number fluctuates. It's not a hard dollar amount. Goes to 2 cents go to transit operating, and 1 penny goes to highway maintenance.
Okay, but it doesn't go to pay off the debt service. I mean,
it actually pays off the Route 58 bonds and the Northern Virginia Transportation District bonds, and there's a Chesapeake bond, but not the $3 billion.
No,
correct.
Okay, thank you. I was getting really confused there.
So I guess the point of that last bullet is that basically in that 10-year period from 08 through 17, we've lost $600 million of bonding capacity based on the underlying revenues. The next slide is basically to get a little more into the detail of exactly the impact of the estimates and why we're bringing a revised 6-year program to you for your consideration at the December board meeting. Essentially, for that 6-year period, 2010 through 15, we're looking at about a $98 million loss in revenues, about $79 million in transit and $19 million with rail. Those reductions for fiscal year 10, and which there in turn will relate to the operational reductions that we'll be speaking of in a minute. Essentially, we're looking at about a $10, $11 million or 7.5% roughly reduction in transit revenues, and rail almost 10% for just fiscal year 10. And getting to the actual impact on our grantees, we're basically looking at the capital grants funded with Mass Transit Trust funds will experience a 7.8% decrease in the state participation. The net impact here is we were funding at about a 77% level of non-federal share. Now it's going to be 71%. And I bring that point up because we talked earlier about bonds and our reliance on bonds. If we didn't have those bonds to fund another large section of our capital request, we would probably be in the 20% share state funding. So just to reiterate how important the bonds are, also to our program, we would be in about a 20% match ratio as opposed to the last 2 years we've been between 65 and 75. As far as operating, you see the large urban providers are going to receive a 5% cut in their state funding. And fortunately, we had the provision to flex, for lack of a better word, the 10% of our ARRA funds, which that coupled with full utilization of our FTA 5311 rural operating funds allowed us to hold harmless both our rural and small urban providers for fiscal year 10. Therefore, they did not have to come up with more local funds. And our funding, basically, the best way to look at it is the mix of our funding changed a little bit more from a federal perspective than our state dollars. I guess the other bullet here is the capital item does impact it from a perspective. I think there's a list y'all might have. I believe you have a 6-year program, and at the back we put some supplementary schedules, and there's a list of the providers. It's 7 providers that are impacted by the capital grants. And I guess the last bullet is basically getting at, we did not deallocate any our capital projects. We made an allocation of about $18 million in April, if y'all recall. And then there was about $12 million left to be applied for, and that's the $12 million remainder is where we took about $2 million or $2.8 million to make whole the operating. So we didn't take away from any existing capital project. Finally, the impacts of these reductions also trickle down to our administrative budget. Back in June, we had about an $8.7 million administrative budget, which includes basically our HMO funding that we get via VDOT, and then also the 3% that we're allowed to take off the top of the Mass Transit Trust Fund, the Rail Enhancement Fund, Rail Preservation Fund. And as a result, obviously, if the revenues go down, the percentage that we're taking off the top is going to go down. So that's the first 3 lines here is just showing that as those revenues decreased, we're also decreasing our administrative budget. in proportion. And the final line is we also had a across the board 10% reduction to our budget as pushed through the governor's process to balance the budget. So, and that's basically those cuts have been handled through. We have a total position level 40, and we're going to hold, I think, 36 filled, and we're going to hold four positions open. And then beyond that, we're not going to utilize as many consultant services that as we were prior. We're going to probably do fewer compliance reviews, scale back, and probably not be able to provide as much assistance with transit development plans at our providers. But anyway, that's the point here is we've also administratively had to make a cut also. Finally, just the next steps where we're headed. Last month in October, we brought before y'all the that section of capital, the final piece of the capital rural ARRA grants that we recommended to y'all. So tomorrow we would be seeking action on that remaining $10.1 million. At the same time, we've been reprogramming as a result to hold harmless the rural smaller. We've had to do a lot of reprogramming of federal dollars, so we've been in the process of amending those grants to get us to that point where, you know, those providers will not have to take a cut in the current year. Finally, there's a hearing scheduled for the first here to discuss the draft revised program. And then obviously we're looking in December for action on the draft program before you. And with that, I'll hand it back to the chairman and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Pittard. Any questions of Mr. Pittard? Ms. Coulomb?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pittard, the reductions you're making are certainly at a different percentage level than we've made on the highway and road and roadside. It looks like you're still bridging gaps that have opened up with some General Assembly action in the last couple of years that has boosted rail and transit, but also lots of stimulus money. Are you anticipating a couple of years into this six-year program that you're going to face what Ms. Buescher is facing now, which is really her flat statements that she's funding fewer phases on fewer projects? Are you anticipating a couple of years from now that you really have much harder decisions to make?
It's our program works a little differently because we're essentially a funding partner. And as I spoke earlier about the matching share, what I anticipate is the matching share declining. And as the matching share, the reality of that is the matching share declines, the actual transit provider is going to scale back what they're doing. If we get back to a 20% match, you know, that's not very attractive to apply for us for funding. So I don't know if I answered your question directly, but
Mr. Chairman, there's a slightly different set of dynamics at work in the two sections of the budget here, I think. So it's not you're just comparing a different set of dynamics. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond also, Mr. Coulomb, we also have light rail and Hampton Roads that will be starting up in a year or two, and shortly after that, a Dulles Rail project. And both of those will be seeking the same operating funds that you see declining here. So we are looking at a pretty serious problem.
That's an excellent
very good point.
No good deed goes unpunished. Okay, any other questions or comments? I'd just like to close again to highlight the major issues that VDOT and DRPT have presented to us, which is the reliance, some would say over-reliance on debt is a very, very critical issue, and if we cannot issue the full amount of the bonds, we have a very serious both programmatic and financial problem. Number two, it's very clear that we are not meeting our maintenance and operational responsibilities, whether it's the condition of secondary urban highways or the declining reimbursement rate for local transit operators. Number three, with the small amount of revenues that are available and keeping projects moving, it is very important that there is a jobs focus here, and particularly with the Department of Defense, whether it's in the 95
corridor to serve the growth at Belvoir, or the 564 project to serve the naval installation that is very, very important to attracting and retaining the largest employer in Virginia. Lastly, and I think Dr. Davis and Mr. Kulina hit this nail very much on the head, we are changing the state-local relation. It is not by choice. It is not healthy for the Commonwealth, but it is a feature of this draft program, and so we do have some hard choices before us between now and December. We'll take a break till 4:30, and we're going to come back, if I may. We're going to move a couple of items so that we can leave some time to talk about the 29 corridor study and the VTRANS document. The other items, I suspect, we're going to have to push off until tomorrow. So that would be the rail access, the high-speed rail, the I-73, 460, Virginia Capital Trail, and the blueprint update item 14 will likely get pushed off till tomorrow morning. Mr. Kulmay.
Mr. Chairman, before we break, I have a question. Given just how federally heavy our program is now, do you have any insight about what the federal government may or may not be considering in terms of a new reauthorization that would either positively affect this picture or potentially negatively? Have there been any details that have emerged yet?
Ms. Kulmay, that's a great question. No one really knows. The authorization has expired, and they're on, I believe, six-week extensions is the program. If you look at the revenue base, they can only afford about two-thirds of the program. So if you follow, there's a Byrd Act at the federal level. The same guy did it. And that does require a reconsideration of the federal program to bring it in line with available revenues. If they followed that, they would reduce it by about one-third. So we'd be going from roughly $900 million a year of federal revenue reimbursements down to about $600 million. So that would have instantaneous consequences, principally for bridges and for transit projects in Virginia. Okay, we'll come back at 4:30.
Well, look at the birds you got there.
Well, I mean, what are they supposed to
do? Yeah, I know. Oh, yeah, well, that's true.
Downtown.
That's part of this midtown. Again, it's part of that PPTA program.
I went to a convention, and the first time I've been here through that one, they said I could have been 64 years old now. But that was the first one here.
32?
Yeah,
which only.
Where did you go to a convention?
Route 29.
Oh.
Which hotel was
it? Oh, the Marriott.
Okay, yes, that was downtown.
Yeah.
You should have called me.
I'm a block.
Yeah.
I look out my window at the Marriott.
Yeah.
I'm offended.
I know. I'm sorry. I'll be.
I'm late.
But I was thinking.
Okay.
Yeah, I have a song about it. I'm already here through with all the women out of OC. Let me get three of the women coming over. That is awesome.
Well, you know, VDOT just changed the policy. Yeah. 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 And it just backed up. Three or four times.
9/11,
1 and 2:30, yeah. And so you could go downtown and it's open on demand. It'd be open for a half hour. That would close and those should get on. Yeah, it was unbelievable.
Well, I'm never quite up to reading this part of the game, but I'm
okay. I used that downtown tunnel over. Leave me
the back. We all should be able to get a really good time.
I can get that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
trying to squeeze over so you can miss that same side of the white line.
I don't think it's put up.
Color it back.
But we're in the
This guy thinks I'm going to fly a flex jet. I don't even have a place to fly to. I didn't stay for a lot of the meeting, though, Dana. I talked to Dennis before, and here's last night, just when I got in touch, and to see if they were going to be public, and weren't made public this afternoon, so all I told them that we'd be discussing it for approval, and that they put their input to December 1st. I'm going to call Dennis to see. All right, we know what they cut, Dennis. Can you go now through and tell us what they added back so we can see how it's fair? Well, we might, you know, I don't know. Rita said that it wasn't just what they took away. They put, you know, in other words, it wasn't revenue neutral in terms of it was positive. How much they put on, so she just couldn't recall how much she put on.
Both of the four stars that I talked to
are you going to dinner tonight?
I mean, the number changed. When Dennis first gave me the number, it was 173. Then it was 380. He got something else from Rita. I go, Dennis, what is the number? Because, I mean, I keep adding it up. It's a different number. I mean, 56 out of 383 ain't as bad as 53 out of 173.
They were going through
a whole different picture.
That's exactly right.
It looked very deep.
Come back and get it.
I'll come back and get it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we'll do that. That'd be great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you know where the restaurant is.
Approximately.
All right. We'll find it. As long as you got it, you know where we're going, then just come back.
You got a GPS? It might put it.
Yeah, right. I got a GPS.
Yeah, we'll put it in the GPS.
All right. Sounds good.
So you got to go up Broad Street, come back the other way, come back this way on Cherry or we got no
quick
come back.
I better put up the GPS. Yeah. But no, that'll be good. That way we can come back. And I'll find it.
Those are just ones that we got
around here. Yeah, and
good. Okay.
But it's interesting that you guys are breaking down. You can't afford it.
How are you?
Agenda item 12. What agenda item? Then we're, and here we are. That's capital.
Can I go and show that?
Oh.
Great.
That's it. I can just leave that there. What? Oh, you need a laser. You need a laser to show them in and out. Do you have a laser?
I'll be in then I'll go up the road.
How come it's not working?
Because it's not, it's a, oh, you have the laser.
What?
I think he was just beating
himself.
talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Okay.
And it takes a very long period of time.
what they decided in 2001 was a change from what they decided a month before. Well, what's happening now is that it's going back to the document, and it's getting more discreet than the staff originally recommended. Staff's not going to, I don't think they're going to, not out of an hour.
Yeah,
not out of an hour. Basically irrelevant. But as far as environmental, most of the concerns, from the district. And I just read it over if ask whatever questions you have.
The next item on our work session agenda is the Route 29 corridor study, and Dr. Mary Lynn Tischer and Mr. Joseph Springer will be making that presentation. Welcome, Dr. Tischer, and I would be remiss if I did not, most of the board are aware, but Dr. Tischer has received a wonderful promotion going to Washington, D.C. to be one of the heads of the policy office for the Federal Highway Administration. We'll get your title when the cards are printed, and I know several of the board members are going to want to thank you personally for your great service to the Commonwealth, and even more so for the good work that will come out of Federal Highway Administration on behalf of the
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary. I want to say it's been an absolute pleasure being a participant in your discussions and working with you over the past couple of years, and I want to thank you for all the kindnesses that you have given me, and you in particular, Mr. Secretary and Mr. Commissioner. With that, I'll talk about the Route 29 corridor study. If you recall, the Commonwealth Transportation Board commissioned the Route 29 corridor study from North Carolina to Gainesville. It is a recognized principal arterial and designated national highway system route interconnecting three MPO areas and connecting some of the rural parts of Virginia to northern Virginia. The corridor functions to serve long-distance traffic as well as local traffic. And it's also important that Norfolk Southern provides rail service along the corridor. This study was an attempt to develop a blueprint for short, mid, and long-term improvements to the corridor. And I'd like at this time to reintroduce Charlie Rasnick, who was the Commonwealth's project manager, who oversaw this the study, and then Joe Springer from the Parsons Transportation Group will pick up with the presentation now and go through the rest of the recommendations.
Welcome, Mr. Springer.
Thank you. What I'd like to go through is just some of the background and particularly the outcomes of the study. The process that we went through, we started on board last October. One of our key goals in the study was really to engage in conversations throughout the corridor to identify at a high level some common themes and some consensus ideas of what could be done on Route 29 to address the needs of the entire corridor. Initially, I'd just like to talk about some of the vision and goals for the corridor. Overall, the first goal really is to preserve the functionality of the corridor for through travel. It is Central Virginia's primary economic travel corridor. And it's maintaining that and enhancing that certainly is of crucial importance to the economy of Central Virginia. The third item here, improving the safety and reducing congestion. There are particular areas in the corridor where congestion is certainly a bigger issue than others, but those congestion points do affect the corridor as a whole. Fourth item, addressing local traffic. There are particular areas where commuter traffic or more localized traffic is of more importance. The corridor does include three MPO areas, the Danville MPO, the Lynchburg MPO, and the Charlottesville MPO. And within each of those areas, there's obviously a commuting pool and traffic congestion related to that. And in the northern part of the corridor, there are issues related to primarily commuting in and to the Northern Virginia and Washington, D.C. area. And then the final bullet item here, really something that we heard throughout the initial parts of the study with public meetings, is really the value of this corridor as a scenic and historic corridor, and certainly one of the goals, the visions, is to preserve those particular values. Ultimately, the conclusion of some of this is that really this vision is achievable while accommodating expected growth in the corridor, but that needs to be done through more fully integrating land use and transportation planning and looking at ways to enhance non-automobile modes of travel. Some of the study outcomes that are reflected in our draft report are listed on this slide. Basically, what we've got in our draft report is a high-level guide for state, local, regional, and private sector planning in the corridor. And we demonstrate that through a lot of examples, some prototypes, some things that could be done to accomplish and to ultimately achieve that vision through some best practice examples that could be applied really in a context-sensitive way in different parts of the corridor. We did not at any point through the study really look at some kind of one-size-fits-all solution. The intent was to really address some overall planning concepts, but do that in ways that reflect the different character of different parts of the corridor and the need for context sensitivity. The report also does include a section on some recommended policy changes, and I'll talk about that in a few minutes. We're recommending a range of options that could be put in place to change some of the policies so that some of the transportation, existing transportation functionality can be preserved as well as enhanced over the long term. The last item, we did embark on this study with the idea that this would be a model for the other V-Trans corridors of statewide significance. I mentioned earlier that the goal and the whole process of the study involved substantial public involvement, stakeholder involvement, and the consensus themes that we developed were developed through that process. We had 8 public meetings back in February of this year, followed by 4 regional workshops in March. We held throughout the study every other week studio sessions that were held in a different place in the corridor to allow people to come in. The afternoon sessions of those all-day studio sessions were open to the public. We did advertise those through a e-bulletin that went out every Monday morning to get folks understanding exactly where we were in the study and how they could contribute to the process. We also had a technical advisory committee, which consisted of primarily planning district folks and VDOT folks and DRPT folks as well. The other thing we did, pretty much every single elected body in the corridor, boards of supervisors and city councils, we went to each one of those at least once, in some cases several times, and we also had 5 regional meetings back in September and October to review some of the recommendations, and as I mentioned, we did publicize the study throughout with weekly electronic bulletins that went out every Monday morning. Anyway, that process really contributed to developing these corridor-wide consensus themes, and these next couple slides really illustrate some of the things that we heard from folks pretty consistently throughout the corridor that we need to pay attention to. The first item really relates to the idea of access management, basically that there need to be far fewer entrance and exit points on 29, and that parallel roads need to be part of that solution so that not all transportation and not all development is focused entirely on Route 29. Second bullet item, congestion really needs to be addressed in a number of ways, but certainly in the short and midterm, there are opportunities to use technology, regular retiming signals, and better traveler information. Third bullet item, that the travel by non-auto modes needs to be increased, especially transit, looking primarily at bus-type transit, although certainly over the long term, there may be some opportunities for additional rail transit. And tied to that increased bus transit, there needs to be better land use planning that really supports not only transit travel, but also bicycle and walking travel as well. This study really is probably the longest study that really addressed quite so completely the integration of land use and transportation. Our report reflects a lot of that discussion, not only in terms of having land use patterns that support transit, but also land use patterns that support more transportation-efficient roadway plans as well. The other core, the consensus theme we heard from folks was that planning needs to be coordinated across jurisdictional boundaries, perhaps even to the extent of having a corridor master plan, ultimately to be able to put some of those things so that all the jurisdictions are working off the same, basically the same sheet of music. This next bullet item, the idea that VDOT needs to play a stronger role in preserving the transportation investment and really securing it as the economic development resource for Central Virginia. Really ways to provide support for local governments in terms of saying no, putting in stronger access management, being able to say that we need to preserve this corridor and not have as many access points and look for other ways to take care of economic development without having, stripping out the entire corridor with that type of development. And then finally, relating to the vision item, that the corridor is, in fact, a very valuable scenic, historic, and environmental resource, and that must be preserved. from that particular consensus things, we developed some particular prototypes and some high-level concepts in terms of how we can get to this. This particular slide indicates the idea of access management, limiting the number, managing the number of access and egress points, and tied with that is the idea of developing parallel roadway systems. Certainly, even on the access management side, you need those parallel roads to make some of that those closures or limiting number of access points make that work. The diagram you see on the bottom of this particular slide is actually a study in Greene County that was done separately to this study, but it does implement some of the particular recommendations in terms of developing some of that parallel roadway system and minimizing the number of access points. The diagram in the upper right of this slide does show the idea of removing, particularly close to intersections, removing access points and starting to put some of that access on the back side of parcels rather than on the front side. And certainly that diagram, if you extend some of those roads further and carry them much more parallel, further down and parallel to Route 29, you get that idea that we were trying to promote throughout the corridor, that you have these parallel road systems so that they can accommodate local traffic and you don't have to get on and off of Route 29 for every single trip that you have to make. The second item, really the idea of roadway connections, and this sort of in blunt terms is the idea that we need to get rid of the number of traffic signals on 29 and certainly minimize the number of new ones that are coming online. That was one of the major frustrations we've heard from folks throughout the corridor. And there are ways to do that, and our report does indicate that, that there are a number of options and they can be done in a context-sensitive way. The diagram, let's see if I can get this work. The diagram up in the upper right-hand corner shows the idea of a quadrant interchange. We're calling it a quadrant interchange, where basically you have 29 and a local road intersecting, and you have basically development occurring, which typically happens where you've got a gas station and perhaps fast food coming in. And ultimately, if you can build these parallel road systems on either side, connect them to 29, ultimately you can come in and put a simple structure over top of 29 and use these local road systems provide basically an interchange. And that allows you to, one, have a sort of concentrated activity node around an intersection, not have a large interchange footprint, but also lets you get rid of that traffic signal, ultimately have right in, right out, and use your local system as part of that particular configuration of access. The other item I mentioned, the focus on the land use side of things, and again, providing the development occur in activity nodes as opposed to stripping along the entire corridor. And this is as we talk with folks, the idea that it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, where if we can come in and identify that these are the exact access points that you need to have, then you start doing your land use planning around that, or vice versa, you can do your land use planning first and identify the locations where you're going to have access. But ultimately, we want to limit the number of access points, put activity centers around there. Perhaps some of those activity centers can even be off the road, so you maintain the visual character of the road, but you have that access point at that location. But ultimately, you're looking for a situation where you can create communities that are nodal development patterns, that you limit the number of access points, and you provide for access without having to put driveways every half mile or every quarter mile or even more than that. This next item relates to a little bit to the highway side of things, but certainly even more important in terms of promoting and serving transit is these compact development patterns. This particular diagram is an idea of doing that kind of thing around some of the stations, either existing, perhaps long-term future stations in the corridor, some of the smaller communities, and being able to make those more efficient. By having not just these stations surrounded by parking lots, but also have them be places where people could walk to the train station and make their commute to wherever they happen to be going using the rail system. Other items, the rail enhancements, we did look at throughout the corridor, ultimately having the idea of double tracking the rail line throughout the entire corridor to be able to promote more on-time service of the existing system.
Certainly the new Lynchburg to Washington and up the Northeast Corridor line has been very popular, and folks are very much supportive of that and would certainly like to see that continue if possible. The other items, local and regional transit options, we did go into the study recognizing that transit and some of these other options have a value beyond just the number of cars that can take off the road, but it's important to provide people with choices, and certainly that supports ultimately better land use patterns and those kinds of things. Also within some of the urban areas, bicycle and pedestrian travel projects that we can put in place. There are prototypes in our report that show putting some of those bicycle lanes along either the existing roadway or if you put in 29 and convert it to a higher speed in some portions, putting that on some of the parallel roadways that would ultimately serve as the Business 29 route. I mentioned the natural environment and the scenic and historic resources. This is a map actually of the up in the northern part of the Prince William Fauquier County line, mapping out some of the key historic Civil War battlefield areas that were certainly a consideration as we went through this process and would need to be a consideration throughout. The idea through here is that because of the constraints, it really is important that we look at some of these ways to accommodate travel through other modes while preserving the character and the historic value of the corridor as a whole. Talk a little bit about some of the policy recommendations. We went throughout the study talking about a wide range of possible changes to policies, procedures. I mentioned the fact that what we heard from folks was that VDOT needs to take a stronger role in preserving the value of the investment that's been made in the Route 29 corridor. And there are ways that we can start making some of those changes. What we did ultimately is come up with policy recommendations at three tiers. These aren't necessarily exclusive of each other, but they go from basically a voluntary type list of policy recommendations to more of a regulatory, I guess, for lack of a better word, set of recommendations. So tier one, the idea is that the localities would apply the principles that are in the Route 29 corridor study and some of the prototypes, and they do that through detailed access management plans, the Green County example, that the study that they just completed as being an example. Putting in the conceptual roadway networks, incorporating them into their comprehensive plans, incorporating some of these design standards into both the transportation plans and their local land use plans, more or less on a voluntary basis. The second tier would be more related to incentives, using ultimately as funding becomes available, using funding programs, grants, to basically reward compliance to some of these Route 29 corridor study recommendations. We certainly heard a number of times through the study from various local governments that there needed to be a way to reward good behavior in terms of being a good steward of Route 29, preserving the functionality of the roadway. And this really gets to that idea, that ways to develop funding programs and basically on the flip side saying you're not going to allocate funds to any projects where the localities can't guarantee through their land use planning that the long-term functionality of the roadway cannot be preserved. The third tier is what we're calling the corridor-wide stewardship. This involves legislation, plans, and requirements that would be developed jointly by VDOT and local governments as part of what we're calling a corridor-wide implementation plan, effectively a master plan, that requires specific land use and transportation planning activities. The plan itself would be developed through a cooperative effort between VDOT, DRPT, and local governments, but basically once that plan is developed, you would have some level of requirement that the localities really comply with some of the things that are in there. This is obviously the most regulatory-based of the three. We feel like it doesn't preclude the other two tiers of the policies, but in some cases, putting some of these things may provide a more regulatory underpinning to ensure more widespread implementation. A couple things, sort of key study implications that I wanted to highlight and reiterate is the idea that really Route 29 is of key importance for the economic vitality of the entire corridor, and ultimately we are looking for a plan that converts Route 29 over the long term into an uninterrupted flow facility. Basically meaning that we look for all opportunities to take out traffic signals, come up with alternative means to provide access, either through parallel roads or some of these other interchange concepts that we talked about, and do that in a context-sensitive way. there are a number of obviously challenges involved in that, but you know, I think it's important, and we heard from folks that we really need to focus on that particular issue. The second item is, and driving forces to some extent to the study as a whole, was these major congestion points in the Charlottesville-Albemarle County area and in the Fauquier-Prince William County area. In the Charlottesville-Albemarle area, the local plans do have are set up to basically implement a little bit of this parallel roadway concept, and we certainly the study does certainly go along with those recommendations. In addition, looking for some construction of interchange at some of the key intersections in that area, particularly Hydraulic Road, Rio Road, along with a new bridge across the South Fork of the Rivanna River, really implementing some of that particular parallel roadway concept that they were looking for. And then finally, in the northern part of the corridor, there are certainly the travel demands, the forecasts that we looked at are suggesting significantly higher volumes on Route 29 than there are today. So it's certainly doubly important to look for ways to avoid having traffic signals come in there, and additionally looking for ways to encourage traffic commuting by using other modes of travel. A couple other items to mention. This study does not include a recommendation to construct the Charlottesville bypass. And there is a time limit on the right-of-way that VDOT purchased some years ago for that right-of-way and what can be done with it. Ultimately, if it's not used for transportation purposes, state and federal law requires that it be sold.
I haven't been a part of a lot of this discussion, so this may be like throwing a bomb in the middle of a conversation, but I listened to the whole presentation, and it came to this, and this stands out exactly opposite of everything that has been said and done in this study all the way up to this point. And it just struck me as strange. Now, I know Butch and Jerry and a lot of other people have been involved in this discussion a lot more than I have, but how in the world you could arrive at that conclusion after listening to this presentation, and especially to dispose of the property that you have for a bypass, what logic that makes, I'm really desperately seeking to try to understand. Do you want to let him attempt that, or should we let some of our distinguished colleagues tell me?
That's one probably more appropriate for our distinguished colleagues to address, but it is a recommendation and one that the board has to take up at the December meeting, so I think conversation is in order. I don't know if any of the folks in the corridor want to take a step. This issue has been around since the late 1990s, and irrespective of what the board ultimately decides to do, we are attempting to bring this forward and not let it languish, and to make a clear, bring forward a clear recommendation and then a clear action by the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Mr. Davis.
Yeah, I think this is a fairly politically sensitive issue. I think you own us with that premise. The problem is we have expended, and by we the Commonwealth has expended $40 million in acquiring right-of-way. It does not own the land that's the terminus of it at the entrance to Forest Lakes in Albemarle County. It has significant money yet to expend to finish acquiring the right-of-way. The difficulty is that where it is located, and one of the members of the CTB who approved the location voted against it. There were two no votes. Originally was Mark Warner, and he said by the time you get ready to build it, it's going to be antiquated. Growth will have passed it. Well, that's exactly what's happened. Now north of it are major developments which now block the extension, the potential extension of it. You have Hollymead Town Center, you have the airport, you have Forest Lakes on the other side, you have the UVA Research Park, you have North Point, the Chuck Rodkin development, you have the Defense Institute. So you're sitting there with the Defense Intelligence Agency, I guess is the northernmost point, which is about 3 miles shy of Rutgersville in Greene County. The actual extension and how you would get there now is questionable. The route is certainly questionable. In this process, there was discussion about promoting an eastern route. In the middle of the discussion of that, the line was put on the map, and I think, Ken, actually in Lynchburg it was shown as a potential, up my way it created a firestorm, because what happened was the line was put on the map, but it went through communities like Rapidan that are historic communities. It went through land like Montebello, which is a historic home, part of the Taylor property. It went through properties like Woodbury Forest, or scooted right around Woodbury, automatically had the opposition to Woodbury Forest. It created a huge backlash. The intent was to begin to work for consensus. We knew that at some point, and it started the discussion, and Pierce is right, the discussion on the right-of-way that had been acquired became a sensitive issue, because if you're looking at spending $250, $300 million on a six-mile road, and it's not really a bypass, and it's not going to be used, how do you dispose of the right-of-way? And that has become a very sensitive issue. We're sitting there holding part of it, not all of it, and after a period of time, the property owners who sold the VDOT have a right to buy it back, and we are facing that. So we have to develop at some point a plan. That became clear that we're not going to actually begin construction. We could go ahead and move some dirt and argue and maybe extend it a little longer, but the likelihood of that doing anything significant or being feasible just does not appear realistic. The only thing that appeared realistic was to dispose of it, get the money out of it that we have invested in as much as possible. Originally, that was not expected to be part of the report. I think it was an evolution. But there was to be a corollary to that, and that was an alternate route. There was a general consensus that a bypass of Charlottesville is needed. The problem is there was also, I think, a consensus that it didn't need to be where it was planned and where we are right away. That's pretty much where we are now. So we're going to have to do something on that right away within the next 2 to 4 years, because property owners are already calling. This runs through Jack Sanford's front yard of Faulkner Construction. I mean, he is going to be there on the day that he's able to make an offer to buy it back. He is going to be there to pay for it. And there are a number of other people who've already indicated they want their land back. We've got to figure out how we're going to handle that when that starts occurring.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. White, for an opposing point of view.
Speaking to Dr. Davis's point, I think you've gotten to the heart of it, and it's why I'm so opposed to this study, the adoption of this study by the board. I've got great respect for the Parsons Group and what they have done. But they came up with some very, very imaginative solutions to the congestion problem around Charlottesville, utilizing the right-of-way Butch just described, not for a bypass, not for a parkway, but for the county road to help alleviate some of the problems on two main intersections on the existing alignment of Route 29 at Hydraulic Road and where it intersects with Route 250. The Board of Supervisors in Albemarle apparently reacted very strongly against that. It was taken out before we even have a chance to see it. A similar problem, they came up with a very creative solution to the problem that those same two intersections that would involve an overpass, most of which was in the city of Charlottesville. The Charlottesville City Council was opposed to it, therefore we don't see it. I think we had a great opportunity to lead here, and I think we've squandered that opportunity. We talk about a vision in here. It's really a backyard vision. We're looking locality by locality, and God help us if we adopt this as the template for the rest of our corridors of statewide significance. This board, has the responsibility to lay out a statewide vision. And just because a board of supervisors or a city council don't like something initially, you know, we could have sent them an email or maybe even spent enough for a first-class stamp and asked them the same question, what do you want to do? Nothing. We would have known that right away. And that's basically what those two communities have said. The Parsons Group also concluded that this parallel set of roads that are on the plans in Albemarle really is not sufficient to deal with the congestion problems at the intersection with Route 250 and Route 29. And I guess my problem has been they've made a lot of great suggestions in here, which would serve us well on all of our corridors of statewide significance. But the way this process has come down in the last few weeks, somebody mentioned a minute ago that Butch did, that all these visions in Charlottesville that I was talking about, they were shown all through the Lynchburg district at every public hearing. And all of a sudden, in the space of a week, they were gone. And I find out about it from a newspaper reporter that calls me and says, what happened to so-and-so? I didn't know anything about it. And all that happened before it ever got to the board. So, you know, I'll have a lot more to say about this before we vote on it. But I think the process has been compromised. I think for this to be considered as a template for the rest of our corridors of significance would be a horrible mistake. And as I said, I think we've missed, if we adopt this, we will have missed a great opportunity to lead.
Good.
But I think the rest of the slide is self-explanatory. Obviously, there is a timeline on that right-of-way, so ultimately something needs to be done, or VDOT would need to start disposing of that property, or some kind of extension would obviously have to be redeveloped. Just the last slide here in terms of next steps where we're suggesting we go from here is that the CTV does accept the study as meeting the multimodal concepts for that were originally directed. Requesting that the local governments and planning districts and the MPOs review and adopt the Route 29 corridor study, which is similar to what was done for the phases 2 and 3 study, which was completed in 2003. That report did include the resolutions from all the local governments in it. Directing VDOT and VRPT to follow on with the corridor, developing a corridor implementation program, which really starts to pinpoint in specifics exactly where some of these access points might be and what they might look like. And then requesting future boards start implementing the recommendations, including some of the policy recommendations. The other aspect, we feel like that as part of the study we did, there was a good dialogue throughout the study, and certainly that dialogue should continue, and that you know, perhaps through the corridor-wide implementation plan and other aspects, some of those things can carry forward. That's the presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions or respond to comments.
Okay. Additional comments or questions? Mr. Schwartz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand the frustrations that Jim and Butch and Ken are all expressing here. I share them. I guess we have a sort of a mini version of the Charlottesville issue up in the northern part of the corridor that's related to the Buckland bypass and an ongoing dispute between Prince William Board of Supervisors and the Fauquier Board of Supervisors. The reality is that that dialogue has been a process of talking past each other for years, as these things often are. I know that Joe and Marilyn and Charlie worked very hard to provide opportunities for good feedback on the process. What didn't happen in the process, and I'm a little disappointed about this, and now I see the result of that, what didn't happen is stakeholders with seemingly opposing interests were never really pushed to sit down together and see if they could be creative in trying to find win-win solutions. There was never a forum as part of this, for example, in my neck of the woods for the Prince William supervisors and the Fauquier supervisors to more or less be forced to sit at the same table and talk about the issues confronting them and see if there are opportunities to resolve them, sort of under threat of, if you guys don't figure this out, we'll figure it out for you. I don't know whether, and so the result is here now at the end of the study, we're having a lot of the same sort of toxic conversations that we were having at the beginning. I understand the desire to try to get this finished and move on, and there are good reasons for doing that. I don't know whether it's still possible for some of that type of stakeholder dialogue to still take place before this is finished. But in a way, I'm just making the observation that I think that's what perhaps has been missing from the process, and maybe there's still a way to do it.
Ms. Coulmay?
I had that same feeling as Dr. Davis, Mr. Chairman, that we had sort of proceeded through the problem statement in advance of beginning the study. We've documented the congestion now. We've understood the growth that will occur in the corridor and is occurring from our other studies as well. And that we probably know intuitively that even if the most ambitious transit and rail solutions are implemented in the corridor, still 95% of people are going to travel by automobile. I'm confused by why, therefore, something like a bypass becomes a negative, but then it reemerges as parallel. I mean, it seems to be a semantic difference with no real difference in meaning. What we're trying to do is relieve congestion on a major artery in some way. I take Mr. Davies' point that it may be in the wrong place now based on so forth, but I'm inclined to, without a much more ambitious set of plans, to agree with Mr. White that this actually hasn't progressed us beyond where we were. And I do think we've squandered an opportunity. I remember there was some energy in the room when we convened local officials plus the public members of the General Assembly, the two ends, and so forth. But the fact is, we have to face the facts. We need additional highway capacity there, as well as improvements in the free-flowing. We need all the other things as well. But I think we've understated that challenge about capacity. And acquisition right-of-way is not easy. If we have some, I'm very hesitant to turn it loose without really making an effort. And I understand the clock's ticking, but I don't think we should be rewarding recalcitrance in local governments. I mean, that's been a hindrance where we are, and we've learned to actually work past that, just because, you know, otherwise we would have choked to death by now. So I think you're right. The responsibility of CTB is long-term. It has to be visionary. We can't deny what's really happening. I mean, we can wish that things were different, but we have to be realistic and know that they're not. And I am very disappointed that there's not a more robust set of recommendations here that would allow us to really challenge local governments and fulfill our responsibilities at the state level. This is a state highway. This is something that's a vital corridor for us, and we can't allow local governments to just pick it apart for their reasons that are also big, with their neighbors in front of them, and it's huge, and you can't trust him because he has that property, and remember when in 1861 something happened. I mean, this is critical for us. If we don't get this right, I agree, the Carters actually have no significance even for the localities. And there's a good model for how to resist. Just wait it out. Just be negative for a couple of decades, and you can make sure nothing happens.
Mr. Right. McCarthy, Mr. Davis.
Could be. Well, being totally innocent on this, not being a part of the process at all, I do have to say that I am a little troubled by the capacity of one level of government to stymie the ability of another level of government to make a decision and get on with something. I also think it is unrealistic to think that we, the state, can simply impose something on localities who don't want it, who can find limitless ways, as the school may have just pointed out, of stymieing our wishes. And believe it or not, after almost 30 years of experience with alternative dispute resolution that we have funded and seen work in many complex local, state, interjurisdictional issues, I'm convinced that if that was not a part of this study process, then we really did miss an opportunity for leadership by not imposing that on not the stakeholders, as some call them, but I would say on the decision makers, the local government elected officials who, as Peter said, need to be at the same table. And if they don't like it, they ought to get used to it, because I think that's the only hope we have of getting something rational out of this. And it's obviously not going to be done by next month, but I really do think that alternative dispute, in fact, it's such a good practice that 20 years ago the Chief Justice put it into the state law to require ADR in a lot of civil proceedings, almost all civil proceedings in this state, before letting a case go to trial. And it has eliminated incredible amounts of litigation over those years and saved the Commonwealth and the litigants a heck of a lot of money in the process. And I don't know what we do as a policy here at CTB regarding alternative dispute resolution, but if there was ever, if you want to do a template for how to do corridor planning, I think that's got to be a part of it, because there's too many people who can veto things here and who have got to be forced to the table to come to some kind of an agreement. And if this study did nothing else for me, from what I hear about it, it says that is a rational way to proceed, and we ought to try to impose that on a solution, because I don't think we're at the point where we've really solved anything. If we've come all this way and we're back to where, as Ken said, we could have found this out with an email or a stamp or a phone call. So obviously it didn't work. And my experience, ADR can work. It works much more often than it fails, and I think it's something we ought to seriously consider sending whoever is supposed to do this. And I got plenty of people I can suggest to look at for who does this kind of work, who would love the opportunity to do something in a real leadership position for the Commonwealth and the Commonwealth Transportation Board if this one's ever going to get resolved.
Dr. Davis and Mr. Davis.
I just have a quick point. Even in our little LETRAN session, I was troubled by legislative authority on the part of CTB as relates to these corridors of significance. And, it would be helpful to me to know a little bit more than I know about what is our legislative authority to deal with creating these and actually implementing policy related to the long-term development of them. Can I have some help on that?
Probably not right at the moment. I'm being flipped, but it's a statewide planning is methodologically difficult. You really have four or five separate corridors. They all just happen to be called Route 29. It's the rare trip that goes from Danville to Gainesville. But yet we pretend as if, you know, that's part of it. But one of the legal responsibilities of the CTB is to locate and designate routes. And so this is well within the purview, both planning and then the subsequent overseeing the execution of that is in the purview of the
But
the
words, Mr. Chairman, the words corridors of significance, that's something we created?
That's a statutory designation that's just passed recently by the General Assembly to try and be proactive in identifying transportation corridors, not just highway, not just rail, not just transit. Personally, I think it ought to cover all modes of infrastructure. Electricity location is a very, very controversial. Actually, in this same part of the world, we ought to be trying to lump those things together.
Thank you.
For good planning. Mr. Davis.
A couple of points. We have talked about mediation and bringing people together. One of the frustrations of this was that we seldom had the elected leadership attend any of the meetings. They said stay in. And they made it very clear when there were follow-up telephone calls that they'd wait and see what the document looked like first. It was much easier to raise objection to the document once they'd seen it. If they got involved in it, and their fingerprints were on it, and they were hesitant to participate. And I think that may very well have been uniform. There were members of the locally elected government and a couple of legislators who attended, but there was an effort made repeatedly to hold a meeting at a single location with legislators and local government leaders. It got postponed at least twice, if not three times, because of failure of those individuals to respond. And part of it is what the secretary just said, is that 29 is a different road for different segments. And so it became very hard to get them to come. When you indicate to them that part of our purpose was to build a consensus, an agreement on that 29 corridor, it was almost as if, I don't know about that. That they backed up on it. And I think that became a real challenge. The proposed bypass, the Buckland bypass that Peter talked about, the proposed Central State Parkway, which was the alternate eastern route, which was put on the map, which was brought out, generated instantaneous opposition from diverse groups. Some of the people who are supportive of a bypass around Charlottesville came to the meetings to oppose that particular concept because where they put it, the line on the map, wasn't where any of the people in those communities wanted to go. It led to what else could you do? Could you look at the Route 15 corridor? Could you look at improvements? It started diverting from the Route 29 corridor completely in those discussions. So I think it really is a very difficult situation trying to get the active input of local leaders and members of the legislature who basically said, you know, you all are trying to put this together, you put it together, and then we'll let you know what we think of it. And when the draft report went out,
you wouldn't want to.
It was instant. I mean, and as you went from public meeting to public meeting, the temperature of that meeting accelerated. I mean, 200 people showing up at a public meeting with almost no notice. It changed, and the local legislators and the local government leaders, you know, immediately reacted to that as well.
So. Mr. White.
I agree with Butch that one of the objectives here was to achieve consensus among the stakeholders and the governing bodies along Route 29. But the consensus process was never intended, from my point of view, to be the local veto before it even got to the board. We hired, or VDOT hired a consultant to make recommendations to this body. I've seen some of those recommendations. Butch has, Peter has, maybe Doug has, but the rest of the board have not because they've been eliminated. Now, If we are really going to lead in the area of planning our corridors of statewide significance, the fact that a locality initially doesn't like what our consultant is proposing, while it's important to us, it shouldn't be determinative of the issue. We should see what the consultant is recommending and make our own decision, and then go back to the localities, whether it's through alternative dispute resolution, whether it's what Peter suggested, but in some fashion, the board is then leading trying to put those communities together so that they can come up with something that they may not totally like, but at least it's something they can stomach, and it fits into the vision of a statewide corridor of statewide significance. That's where our failure was. Consensus, at the very point of suggesting an idea, That's not the way we should have done it. And I really hope we don't adopt this as a template for the future. Thank you.
Okay.
If I can quickly respond to Mr. Davies' comment about we did try several times to have that meeting, and as you recall, when I was here last time, you all expressed a desire to encourage members of the General Assembly to participate, and unfortunately that didn't happen. And we were trying to get those corridor-wide meetings where we could have a discussion other than at a presentation at a local board of supervisors. That's not a format that's conducive to conversation, certainly not conducive to any kind of cross-jurisdictional conversation. It couldn't have been of our job to go from one jurisdiction to the other and say, these guys said this and these guys said that. That's not terribly productive. So, that type of meeting, I wholeheartedly agree, would have been very useful. We're, as a result, not having that is a little bit why we are where we are.
Commissioner?
At the risk, I would not be too quick to deem a process and the engagement that has gone on over the last year, as Brandon's labeling it so quickly, as nothing gained, and what we have learned from the process has narrowed and brought us to a point where we can focus, I think, on what the real issue is. Mr. White has brought one of those key issues to the table now. There is the issue of the right-of-way that we purchased in anticipation of a bypass, and I think it's fairly clear that against that deadline that the prediction was made was is of the usefulness of that right-of-way. You know, from what I've seen, it is clear that that's not the right thing to do. The third option that we have on the table is recapturing the capacity within the existing 29 corridor. What we've also highlighted here this afternoon is what has changed since I started in this business in the early 1970s and late 1960s, which was the unilateral authority of highway departments to place corridors wherever they felt like it. We don't do business that way anymore, and I need to be very, very clear about that. In every state in this country, there are a series of checks and balances. If I talk to you in Minnesota, I will tell you that a municipality, that is a local unit of government, I am prohibited as commissioner by doing anything within that municipality without consent of the local board. They will wait until I bring them the construction package and then not approve it. That is what CLRPs are all about. That is what the MPO process has given us. And we need to acknowledge and understand that so that as we narrow these issues, the art of dispute resolution has significantly changed. It's significantly changed. But this study has brought that to the table so that we can acknowledge it. And as we plot a forward course, we can build from where this study has brought us. That is, and my last point I'll get on my high hat about, when I came here, we were spending millions to accomplish what we've done with much less money in a very much shorter period of time than we have been doing in the past. Those are parts of the model that I think we need to make sure that we don't lose as we move into other corridors. We're proving that you can get to where you focus, where you need to focus, without having to spend years to do it, without having to spend millions to do it. That's significant, very frankly, in the way we do business. That will pay us benefits as we go forward. I'm very excited about the opportunity to have the debate that Mr. White and the rest of the board has brought to the table, because I think we're getting at the real policy issues that need to get kicked around here. So as we move forward, and I'm hearing that as we get ready for that discussion next month or the resolution next month, we probably do need to spend some time talking about the framework of decision making so that the board can in fact assess the probabilities of success in the longer term.
Mr. Chairman, in connection with what the commissioner just said, could we have an addendum here that shows the lessons learned going through this specific study as we try to look at a model that would be applying to all of the other quarters? Because what he stated is not a part of the recommendations here that we're going to have to vote on. Because there's benefit for this study, and he gave me a whole...
It all depends what the motion is.
his explanation gave me a whole new look at the benefits of this study. Because if we listen to Ken, you know, I'm not ready to adopt a model for statewide studies that has all these holes in it. However, after the commissioner gets through, I think there's a lot of lessons learned out of this particular study that we might begin to analyze and look at and begin to moderate a review, if you will, or dissolve.
I got to be very honest with you that I'm setting this up because in the redesign of VDOT, I'm going to talk to you about tomorrow. This style of planning is what we're moving into all the districts as a way to do business so that we can get closer to the local community and move it much more quickly. This is a center point of living our mission as an agency.
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Davis.
May I ask the commissioner then, with this study, did we give clear direction to the consultants and to the parties that started the study that one of our goals was to have maneuverability along this corridor at a certain level of efficiency? Was that an original expectation of doing this study?
Yes. I mean, that was part of we were looking at mobility, functionality, safety.
If that's true, Mr. Chairman, I would say I didn't see anything or hear anything, and I'll go back and read this again tonight, that addressed the fact that this corridor study gives us any level of comfort that there's maneuverability or at any particular level of efficiency for traffic to go through this corridor.
As
a matter of fact, I heard that there's probably three or four corridors, some of which, having driven it, are very nice. Down by Lynchburg and out around the bypass, it's fantastic. Going through Fauquier County is a nightmare. Getting down close to Danville in that area and south of Lynchburg is a huge challenge. So I didn't hear any real serious addressing of ability of traffic to move along this corridor at a certain level of efficiency. That was the primary reason I think we would do the corridor of significance in a way, as we learn these lessons that we're learning about how to cooperate with local governments and MPOs and all the different groups that we've created. I don't argue that, and I don't think we should have the power just to draw a line and say that's where the road's going to go. But I do agree with Jerry that I think there comes a point where you do have to arrive at a decision, and the mechanisms that you have in place to arrive at that decision used to be you had condemnation and the courts. If that's no longer going to be the case, we need a new method in order to make decisions, because if we don't, we won't make any decisions. And this report is an example of not making a decision, just describing a situation that exists, in my opinion, at this stage. So I'm curious. I was sort of asking you, you know.
Mr. Chairman, I think it goes back, and Mary Lynn can probably talk a little bit about it, but early on I saw some data, and it depends on the trip from Danville to Gainesville. And what is the added time, that's the message you're getting to, as you wait at a stoplight versus having a free-flow interchange or a free-flow freeway to get from Gainesville to Danville. And the Secretary's point, I suspect there is data in the report that will show you what percentage of the trips go from Danville to Gainesville, what the difference in time is, because I know I've seen the data. And I think that enlightens your point.
It does. That's what troubled me in our VTrans conversation about these corridors. I was trying to decide what is really significant about these corridors. Is it being able to get from point A to point B in a certain period of time? Is it to drive through a beautiful countryside road that's environmentally protected? Is it to get truck traffic from point A to point B? And I'll be honest with you, there's no consistency through any of these corridors that we've identified that we could say this is the standard that we're going to hold you to, and we want you as local government to arrive at some compromise with the Commonwealth on how we address these particular issues. I see you smiling because you know exactly the issue I'm raising, and each corridor study will be so different, it'll be unreal, based on my quick looking at the corridors that we have and why we've even refused to consider extending some of those corridors to make them a lot more economically efficient or whatever. It has to do with the political conflict that exists without a way to resolve it in this day, because the old take the land and sue is just not effective anymore.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Mr. Davis, if I could make a comment. With respect to the significance of the recommendations that are in the report, and Joe went through these rather rapidly, but the Tier 1, the Tier 2, and the Tier 3 in particular, I think, are fairly robust recommendations relative to the essentially, it is unfortunately a next step, because, as I say, the best of plans. We had anticipated a lot more political involvement by the localities throughout this whole process. We expected a lot more involvement by the General Assembly in this process. And so we had initially felt that we would be further down the road than in fact we are. But that is what the corridor-wide stewardship tier number three is all about. And the recommendations essentially depend on your will as to just how far you in fact want to go. And it's clear that certainly tier one with the voluntary recommendations is certainly implementable as long as anybody wants to implement it. Tier two is implementable as long as you have money to provide the incentive structure. Tier three then depends on whether there's a will here and then in the General Assembly to go forward with regulatory requirements. So there are some fairly robust recommendations, I would say, in here relative to that. And then I also want to follow up on what the commissioner said, and that is that federal law requires the Metropolitan Planning Organization to essentially put into the Transportation Improvement Program any plans that they want to go forward with. And there can not be, no one can go forward with something that's not in the TIP. In the Transportation Improvement Program by the Metropolitan Planning Organization.
Mr. White, final word.
Just one point. I know, Mr. Secretary, you want to move on, but there.
No, I don't.
I've been misreading.
I've been enjoying that.
I don't think there's any federal law, though, that says you have to accede to the request of an MPO or a locality in a situation like this where the state has employed a consultant to look at a corridor-wide view.
Correct.
And report back to this board. That's where I think we have fallen down. That is where we have made a serious mistake by eliminating all this stuff that our consultant recommended that we haven't even seen. And I'm going to keep repeating that until you're sick of it. That is a very serious problem. Thank you, sir.
Okay. One specific, I do have a piece of correspondence from Prince William County who have asked, is the Buckland Bypass in or out as of the recommendation?
The Buckland Bypass is not in the recommendation.
So is the status of that the same as the Charlottesville Bypass, saying we don't think that should be built?
That's correct.
So that is in the same posture then as Charlottesville. There may be another location there as well. Okay, so that's a matter of fact. I would just like to echo the commissioner's commentary that
if you look at the geographic spread of this and you read the details in the recommendations, probably about 90% of the corridor there is consensus. And in the two areas that I'm familiar with, which is the Charlottesville bypass and the Buckland bypass, there have been numerous studies over the last 20 years. And every option that was thrown out there has been studied previously, has been highly controversial and rejected. In fact, I know because in my early days, and unfortunately Mr. Davis isn't, you know, conveniently not here, we spent a lot of money studying that back in 2002 and 2003, this very issue. JLARC looked at the acquisition. One of the drivers, one of the problems with the Charlottesville bypass was a decision long ago to acquire the rights of way in advance of completing the environmental studies. And that decision actually changed federal highway policy in Virginia about advanced right-of-way acquisition, because we now have a $40 million investment that we're unlikely to see realized. And so I think all of us are talking about we need to find a way to do better planning. Couldn't agree more. We also have to figure out a way not to spend money on something that invest in something that we get no benefit from that. And that's a, to me, is the most significant lesson here. And a third issue is to be respectful of prior studies. The days in the 1960s and 70s with a highway engineer and a wax pencil drawing a line on them, I mean, that does not happen anymore. We don't have the funding to do that. And I think we ought to isolate those areas where there are, find the areas that to move forward. Personally, I think the gap between Lynchburg and I-64 is cheap and easy to protect. One of the goals, you know, there are a lot of goals in this study. A lot of it is about market access. You know, worry about the port getting global access or access to Dulles Airport for the economy, for Danville and Lynchburg and other places. Being able to get access to the markets to the north and to the west and to the east is very important. Well, the first step in that is protecting with simple access management. Actually, those are the recommendations there. There are many, many miles of things that can be done fairly affordably. And then perhaps to isolate those areas where there is consensus. I have yet to find a defender of the Charlottesville bypass that says that particular configuration works. So what we need is some other kind of recommendation. I think there may be more detail than, you know, in the presentation. Now, Ken, you've probably seen more of that than other folks, but the notion of parallel roadways is an important one. I'm reminded in Loudoun County, for example, where we're now doing Atlantic and Pacific Avenue on either side of Route 28. That's kind of a similar kind of option. And I think that deserves a little bit more detail. I think if we have a defect here, honestly, it's the lack of participation by our state, the state elected officials in the corridor who asked us to do this. I think it is spending a little bit more time on those areas, not of conflict, but where we have to better define the problem. I'm not sure what the problem is in Charlottesville. I go there periodically. It's impossible to drive around. It strikes me there may be different solutions to get product to market that's being made in Lynchburg than a Charlottesville bypass, if we all agree that's not something that works. So I guess what I would suggest is I do want to schedule this for December. It'll be up to the board to make a motion on this, to be selective about it for folks to talk, but to try and capture at least those things that are positive that can be an incremental step forward, and let's duke it out on the other issues. But I don't believe there are any bad intentions here. There's a lot of history. A JLARC report, half a dozen studies of the Charlottesville. Ken, this is your second go on this. It's a very, very difficult and troubling issue, but it is, when you look at Buckland, again, we paid for another study there. We've had studies, we've had processes, and so we're kind of spinning our wheels on these issues. I don't think that this is a result of bad intentions. It's just a conflict of some very basic interests occurring there.
Mr. Chairman, but there's a larger question. There's a, it's not just a question of vision, it's a question of understand, a sophisticated understanding of what's going on. And I think we're charged with bringing that to the mix. Not that we're all experts, but at least we're trying to be. For example, this was a major road that's been improved. It goes through many historical battlefield and other kind of things. Well, there's no way to resolve that. You're not going to be able to widen 29 through Buckland without destroying the historic part of Buckland. Okay, so if that's your goal, you can do it that way. But you can't pretend that you can do nothing and that there won't be traffic and there won't be additional pressures and that the politics of it get easier just because you wait a while. In fact, the pressures grow and the frustrations grow and the potential to solve a problem becomes less and less easy to do. Right-of-ways are in the wrong place or you can't acquire them or that option gets closed off. So that's part of it. I think the intention clearly of the General Assembly in adopting that language about corridors in the first place was to begin to build the infrastructure that's necessary for the state to reassert some of those things in the face of local opposition. The way you save an historic corridor is you develop other corridors. You don't pretend like you don't need to do anything. We're having that, I can name six or seven other places in Northern Virginia, because we have historic structures, even though we're a big urban area, and all that kind of stuff everywhere, too. But you don't save a Route 15 by pretending like you're not going to make improvements someplace else. But that's what's going on in Loudoun County, for example, right now. It's the same set of, and it's the same denial about that there's a problem and something needs to be done about it. It's like, well, if we just don't acknowledge it, it won't happen, and it can't happen, and we won't have a problem. Meanwhile, you choke. You don't give the guidance that's needed to have proper development. You choke back what can actually occur, and it's a negative process. It's not a stand pat process. It's actually a negative process. So I do think that there's a, that in the absence, I mean, money covers a lot of sins. We've all learned that in our own lives, and we learned that here. As long as you've got plenty of funds, you don't have to think about these things that precisely, because you can just cover, you can just do a little thing and you can get some right away that you're not going to use immediately. It's not a big deal. We don't have that luxury now unless we make these kinds of decisions in a very forthright way. It won't matter when money comes back, if it comes back. We won't have the options in front of us. So I'd like for us to be very serious about this, acknowledge the progress that we've made, certainly, but also realize that this is a point, we're at a point where we need to do this properly, and we need to do this ambitiously. We need to do this, it may be the prime and core function of the board going forward, not the dividing up of large pots of money. And I think probably, you know, my conversations with some of those that have been involved with the corridor idea more recently is they see a need to strengthen it further. In other words, it really is meant to be a tool not to just help localities get along with what they're thinking about, but have them understand, as we have to remind Arlington County occasionally, for example, that 395 is an interstate highway. It's actually not a local road, and it's not just a part of their jurisdiction. It's an interstate highway that's meant to move people, large capacity of automobiles, not just transit, and that it has to be understood in that context. It wouldn't exist otherwise. So I'm not trying to say we should be the ramrods of, and that we know everything that ought to be done, but the fact is, unless we strengthen our own resolve and understand our own role, we'll actually contribute to the undoing of things that those in local governments often think they're helping progress, and they're actually not helping progress at all. And, you know, in this corridor, for example, I love the idea of additional rail service, natural. But that's just gotten cherry-picked from us. We're doing that, and it should have been done in this context. And they say, well, we want that part, but we don't want the other part, so we'll just take that part. Well, we know that part won't solve the problems that we have here. It's a part of the solution, but I think we just have to be more disciplined ourselves. We have to understand our role in a different way. And I don't want to be ugly to anyone. That's not my nature, for one thing. But I do think we have some unique responsibilities, and it's not just let's see what they want to do and see if we can do it.
Okay. Commissioner, last word.
On behalf of the professional community within the department, this last 20 minutes of discussion has highlighted the very dilemma that they all deal with, and that is the sustainability of an initiative. When you look at these corridors, and we talked about the, now I'm going to get misquoted, the lack of political will for continuity over the time frame that it takes to redevelop a corridor like 29. That is the single largest problem that my professional community within the department has to deal with. And you visit it every year as you deal with the six-year improvement program. In order for us to deliver to you a transportation network, we need 20 years of continuous commitment. Can't change radically on us every 6 years, because when it does, you get the Charlottesville bypass. That's what you get.
Okay. Thank you very much. News at 11. I would encourage everyone to think about this and continue discussion. I know there are several people who have come from around the state to talk about V-Trans, and so this will probably make us a little late to dinner, but we need to do that on that. Ralph, I'm going to ask if you can do your next steps tomorrow morning, but Ken, if you could do the subcommittee report now, it would be great. Can somebody cue Ken up? And while that's getting queued up, Dr. Tischer, if we could ask on the 29 study, if we could post that for some additional public comment. I do think, the clarity of the recommendations in that report were not, necessarily there at the outset. And so I know that Prince William County has concerns. Obviously, the 29 bypass is another set, and there are probably other ones that we are unaware of. We should actively solicit putting that report out and see if we can get any additional commentary between now and, say, the 7th of December, something like that.
That would be fine, Mr. Chairman. We'd be glad to do that. And also, we do have copies for the board of the draft final if you want to take papers home with you. Otherwise, we'll be glad to work something else out and send you the link, et cetera.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. White, thank you so much for taking on yet another difficult and thankless task.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. You designated me as chairman. I tried to change my title to ringmaster a couple of times, and the committee resisted it, as did the staff. I think they felt it would adversely reflect upon them if we changed it. Here is the committee that the secretary appointed. There were many who said they looked at this committee lineup and said there's no way you're going to get a unanimous recommendation out of this group. But we did. That's the main message I think we have for you today, is that the recommendations that we have for you are unanimous. Here is the charge that the secretary gave to us. You heard the first two bullets at the last meeting. I made the mistake of asking the secretary to put it in writing, and he snuck in land use at the end. That was not on the list when we started. But the first question related to the corridors of statewide significance. Should there be tiering or prioritization? How should those designations influence funding, and how to go about adding and removing corridors? The second bullet was the investment priorities. Should there be more or other priorities from the ones we looked at last month? And how should the investments in each of those categories be focused? And should we prioritize within the investment priorities? And then finally, land use, the use of regional performance measures, and what incentives can the state use. The committee met all day long, one day, and a half a day to finish up its work. It reviewed the materials you see listed up there, and Jim Davis, the thing that Dave Eckern was smiling at me about is that one of the things we looked at was the Minnesota performance metrics for its interregional corridor systems, and it spoke, you may recall, to the very points you were making in terms of what is the performance expectations we would normally expect out of the corridors of statewide significance. The criteria for selection of corridors of statewide significance, the subcommittee left those unchanged. They're exactly the ones that you looked at the October meeting. The 11 corridors are unchanged except for one minor change on Route 17, which you see in blue. The portion of Route 17 between I-66 and I-81 was removed. That portion apparently is subject to a legislative restriction in terms of not more than 45 miles an hour speed limit and restrictions on expanding or adding additional lanes. There was objection to that, but in the spirit of unanimity, we were able to reach an unanimous conclusion on that. Should there be a tiering or prioritization of the corridors, the committee's recommendation is no. How will the corridor designations influence funding? The committee recommends that that should be one consideration, but not the only consideration. And also, to the extent to which a locality's land use plan protects the functionality of the corridor should be considered, definitely, in funding allocations. Removal or additions to the corridor network, we recommend that none of the corridors be removed that are on the current list, and that the existing criteria that I mentioned earlier be used to identify emerging corridors and designate new ones, and then the CTB should periodically review the corridors to determine the need to add or delete based upon the circumstances. Investment priorities. Should there be more or other categories? Let me flip over to this slide. You will remember, I think, that items 2, 3, and 4, by and large, were listed as priorities in the previous draft. The subcommittee felt that the priorities needed to be more visionary, that we should have a small number of strategic, game-changing mega projects that related to the economy of the state as a whole. And everyone recognized that the existing funding channels were simply not sufficient to deal with those mega projects, and so we recommend the establishment of a strategic infrastructure investment fund. That's item one, and everything on this slide that's underlined is new language from what you saw before. Safety and maintenance is certainly there. That was in the previous draft. We have added using sustainable and environmentally sensitive methods to that category. And we changed the economic competitiveness language from maintaining our economic competitiveness to enhancing it. And we added the bullet points there on the PPTA process, reviewing and refining that process to leverage state dollars, and also developing master plans for the needs of the corridors of statewide significance. And the chair of the subcommittee would add, not through the Route 29 study, obviously. But that is not part of the subcommittee report. and then the fourth category, minimize congestion, that previously read manage metropolitan congestion. We felt that that was simply to manage congestion was not what we wanted. We wanted to minimize it. The land use recommendations essentially are the recommendations that came forth in Nick Donahue's presentation to the board in October. As we discussed then, recent legislation has given the Office of Intermodal Planning and Investment the authority to develop regional and land use performance measures and goals for urban areas and to establish standards for the coordination of transportation investments. These include, but are not limited to, the following. If you remember Nick's presentation on the Fredericksburg example, job to housing balances and housing access to transit and HOV facilities and density around transit stations. The subcommittee recommends the adoption of that approach, and the subcommittee also recommends that the VTRANS 2035 report include the suggestion that future allocation of primary formula funds and discretionary funds should be for projects that help meet those goals. What incentives can the state provide to leverage supportive land uses and promote regional land use planning? Once again, if you recall Nick's presentation, there was a suggestion of the carrot and stick approach. The carrot being competitive grant program, for instance, in all 9 construction districts, with grants awarded locally to projects with land use commitments for development patterns that reduce the demand for transportation capacity. Another approach, who some would call the stick, would be to modify the criteria for the award of secondary and urban formula funds so that localities would only be eligible if they developed a comprehensive plan and promoted development patterns that reduce the demand for transportation capacity and approve zoning proposals to allow such patterns to be built. And if funds were used and the locality chose not to approve zoning proposals, those funds would then be reimbursed to the Commonwealth. That, Mr. Chairman, concludes my report, and I think that our committee has successfully completed the charges that we were given. Recognizing, I think that our committee is still unanimous, but after this report, I'm not sure, so we'll have to wait and see. We stand ready to answer questions. Anything relating to land use, we're going to refer to Nick because he's the resident expert.
Questions or comments? Wow.
Did a great job.
Mr. White, that's a real testament to your abilities, and who knows, we may keep that committee together to discuss the 29 program. As we say, no good deed goes unpunished.
Chairman, an observation probably is all the people that run their mouth an awful lot run that committee, so we probably already
I would, on one of the suggestions, which is about high-speed rail, when we bring that back, and Peter and I have had some discussions about this, I think a little bit of wordsmithing there is in order. And one of the things, really, quietly, what we have done as a Commonwealth, particularly with the advent of high-speed rail, is to talk about a spine of intercity and high-speed rail service, but that is connected to local transit. So if you think about it, you know, the Richmond to D.C. connects to Metro Rail and to VRE and all the associated bus systems. Here in Richmond, when we get to Main Street Station, we'll connect to the BRT here in Richmond, the Main Street Corridor. When we go to Lynchburg, Mr. Badger is negotiating for a bus service to go to the colleges and universities and down to the city of Roanoke. When you get to Hampton Roads, that is the intersection with light rail. And that is the power of those transit investments. And they all have their limitations. So Metro can only go so far. Commuter rail, not appropriate in every set of circumstances. Buses are the most flexible and, you know, the lowest density types of uses. But I'm hopeful that we can find some way to very succinctly characterize that interrelationship between transit and intercity rail. It's very, very important, and this board has done tremendous, tremendous work in that regard. And so I hope we can work a little bit on that. Ralph, is there anything we need to do this evening in terms of your presentation? Can we do that tomorrow in terms of next steps? Okay. One last thing before we break. I know there were several people who traveled here who may not be able to stay over till the morning. I'd just like to give an opportunity to the public. I know I thought I saw Mr. Pollard, Mr. Chase here. If there's any opportunity for public comment, just very, very briefly in order to minimize travel time for folks. Is Tripp still here?
Well, he lives here now, so he'll be back
probably. Oh, okay. All right. Ms. Chase,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say the last 45 minutes or whatever has been some of the most productive and encouraging dialogue that I think I've heard in a long time on transportation, and I congratulate you all for tackling these tough issues. I mean, these are difficult issues, but we really do. We for too long in transportation, I think in recent years, we've been moving towards trying to expand the envelope to try to identify as many possible ways to come at the same problem. And I think, you know, not only the disappearance of transportation funds, but I think even in better times, the reality is that we've got to get towards more focus. That, yes, there are hundreds of things that we could do, but arguably there are investments that rise above others, and I think the responsibility and one of the best things this body can do on an ongoing basis is to help focus attention on those investments that make the most difference. Otherwise, we just deal with lists and we just put money into things and on the basis of something has to be done in the next 50 years, so let's just do this now rather than 49 years from now. And I just want to congratulate you and Mr. White and everybody for what you've done in recent months here. And I think this discussion and the secretary for promoting this discussion, it really needs to continue. I mean, the commissioner, you know, pointed out that we need the political will to have a sustained transportation program. And I would contend that political will starts with this group. Because you need to raise the issues and you need to keep the pressure and the focus on things that really matter. There's lots of things you can do to allocate money to various projects, but keeping the focus on those things are important. And also, I think it's very important, we can't solve the problem just by addressing existing corridors. There's Dulles Airport, there are places in the state where we need new corridors and new ways to get it. Otherwise, we're just going to ruin existing communities by just overloading the existing network. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I appreciate you extending this session tonight, but I really think you're on the right track and you all deserve a lot of credit for the hard work and the good thought that you've put into this process. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chase. Anybody else want to address the board? If not, we're going to recess the work session until tomorrow. Can we begin at 8:30? Is that okay with everybody? And so we can get out at a reasonable hour. Any objections to that? Okay. We'll recess until 8:30.